Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, July 5th, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of a website of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week on our scripture reading. We've been looking in the book of Gospel of John. And let me get that on the screen here. We're in chapter 15. So we'll be picking up chapter 15 as read by Alexander Scorby. Gospel of John, chapter 15.
Chapter 15. I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit he taketh away, and every branch that beareth fruit he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine, no more can ye except ye abide in me. I am the vine. Ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered, and men gather them, and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. Herein is my Father glorified, that ye bear much fruit. So shall ye be my disciples. As the Father hath loved me, so have I loved you. Continue ye in my love. If ye keep my commandments, ye shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments, and abide in his love. These things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you, and that your joy might be full. This is my commandment, that ye love one another, as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Ye are my friends, if ye do whatsoever I command you. Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you, that ye should go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it you. These things I command you, that ye love one another. If the world hate you, ye know that it hated me before it hated you. If ye were of the world would love his own. But because ye are not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they know not him that sent me. If I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin, but now they have no cloak for their sin. He that hateth me hateth my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which none other man did, they had not had sin, but now have they both seen and hated, both me and my Father. But this cometh to pass, that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. But when the Comforter is come, whom I will send unto you from the Father, even the Spirit of truth which proceedeth from the Father, he shall testify of me. and ye also shall bear witness, because ye have been with me from the beginning.
Okay. All right. This evening, we're going to talk a little bit about the jury, the grand jury, and the trial jury. Let me just remove a few things from the desk here. Okay, I'm working on a lot of writing lately, and I guess I think I'm going to try to start another book. I've been writing for a couple of weeks now. One of our focuses is going to be filing some new papers in the court. You know, it's been a while since we filed papers in the court in the Federal District, Northern District of New York here. We've been filing them. And against the United States Supreme Court and the federal judiciary. And ultimately, they're crimes. We've been laying it out for quite some time. People can take a look at that and see that up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. You can read a lot of the papers that we've written under the grand jury action against the judiciary. And we've filed hundreds of papers. But we're about ready to file a very, very important paper. And the timing is most important. And it's not going to be, we're waiting until the military pulls the plug on the deep state. And after that is when we're going to file these papers. And the minions of the New World Order is the Bar Association. They've been working day and night and day, for over 200 years. They've been working in England since, I think it was beginning, I think the British Bar came about around the 1750s, somewhere in that neighborhood, I believe. And the whole purpose of that was to control the people, to bring them into slavery, to destroy common law. Britain was not necessarily a republic, but they were under the common law. And they have severely destroyed common law in England, in Britain. And they tried so also within the colonies. They did a pretty good job of destroying our court system and bringing us into slavery through civil law. Chancery courts were all over the colonies, all over the, all over the, ultimately, America, and at least in its day. And it went out west with them. We've been plagued with chancery courts, which is equity courts, which ultimately, it's hidden as equity court, but it's actually civil law courts. Their jurisdiction's ultimately unknown. And all of our courts today are civil law courts, at least since 1938, bare minimum. But actually, many courts have been around for a long, long time, chancery courts and under civil law. But again, it has gone national, and the federal judiciary sold us out, particularly the United States Supreme Court back in 1938. 8 Supreme Court justices committed treason and signed in the Rules Enabling Act, in accordance to the Rules Enabling Act. The Rules Enabling Act was passed in 1934, and the United States Supreme Court, under the influence of the subversive bar, created the rules, and then they merged together equity and law and called it civil law. And we've been under civil law ever since. Every state has gone under civil law, every town, every village. Our courts have been totally polluted, completely 100% polluted. I don't know if, at least in my lifetime, there has really been a lawful jury. I'm sure there might be some. Well, there's been some juries that found themselves within the power and the ability to do the right thing, but they certainly were not created that way when they were brought into being. And it's a major problem. The most important way of consent of government is consent of law. We the people ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America, for our government. And we laid out very specifically, we are the lawmakers, we laid out very specifically the powers and the authorities that we gave them. And they have just taken more and more and more. And the people have been dumbed down. They have not been taught civil law or civics. They haven't been taught the Constitution. They haven't been taught, really, true American history. You know, we've been researching this for about 12 years now here at National Liberty Alliance, and of course we came to the conclusion with the book Government by Consent, which is the work and our research over the past 10, 12 years. And we have a lot more. We're going to continue to give more information. We've written quite a few books, booklets, shall I say, handbooks. And by the way, the handbook that we have up online right now, if you go to People's Duty and you come down to handbooks, and you can find these handbooks at various other places in on our site, but all of them are listed here. And the one book, the Jurist Handbook, which is 30 pages, I'm going to be adding to that probably another 15 or 20 pages. I'm not too sure, but quite a few pages, I think. At least probably 10 or 15 at bare minimum. There's a lot of stuff that I've been, as I continue my research, that I found that are very, very powerful. There is an essay by Lysander Spooner written back in 1850 or something, somewhere around 1850-something. And in his essay, he lays out the powers and the authorities and government by consent through the jury. We're going to look a little bit at that tonight. So I'm going to be reading out of some of that work and some other things from our founding fathers concerning particularly the focus of we the people are the law. We make the law. Our government writes legislation and writes law in equity only, which controls commercial activity and various government agencies. And so they write the regulations to control all of the different agencies and the statutes and the codes, and that's called equity. But we've never given them, nor ever would we give them, nor could a common law nation ever give them, the authority and the ability to step on God's toes to write common law or to write any law that would subvert common law. But that's exactly what they have done. But again, we're going to take a look tonight at the grand jury and the trial jury and the powers and the authorities. So we're going to read through this. It's only a couple pages. It's 4 pages. It's not going to take too long to read through. And then after that, we'll take some announcements if there are any and some questions that have been sent in. We'll see if Brent is here, and he may talk for a while, and then we'll go to Q&A. We'll see what comes up as we go forward. So, trial by jury, focusing in specifically on Lysander Spooner's essay, a lot of this anyway. Trial by jury. James Madison, the 4th president, hailed as father of the Constitution, said, "We have staked the whole future of American civilization not upon the power of government, far from it. We have stacked the future of all of our political institutions upon the capacity of mankind for self-governance, upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves, to control ourselves, to sustain ourselves, according to the Ten Commandments of God." In the case Bonnet versus Valier in 1886, the United States Supreme Court said, "In common law, the general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and the name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose, since its unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment. In legal contemplation, it is as inoperative as if it had never been passed. Since an unconstitutional law is void, the general principle follows that it imposes no duties, confers no rights, it creates no office, it bestows no power or authority on anyone, it affords no protection and justifies no acts performed under it. A void act cannot be legally consistent with a valid one. An unconstitutional law cannot operate to supersede any existing law. Indeed, insofar as a statute runs counter to the fundamental law of the land, the Constitution, it is superseded thereby. No one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it." Samuel Adams said, "The natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth, and not to be under the will or legislative authority of man, but only to have the law of nature for his rule." In a stunning 6-3 decision, Justice Anton Scalia, in the case of United States versus William, writing for the majority, confirmed that the American grand jury is neither part of the judicial, executive, nor legislative branches of government, but instead belongs to the people. It is, in effect, a fourth branch of government, governed and administrated to directly by and on behalf of the American people, and its authority emanates from the Bill of Rights. Thomas Jefferson, the founder of our natural law republic, said, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. An enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight. It is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided for all its citizens. In Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution, we the people vested Congress with legislative powers to write law in equity only, which is a body of jurisprudence or field of jurisdiction differing in its origin, theory, and method from the common law. Equity is governed by American jurisprudence, which is the science of the principles of equity and legal relations under the rules of common law. Nowhere in our founding documents can you find any authority for Congress to write positive law, also known as equity, to control the behavior of the people, and therefore they have no such power. Whereas under equity, which lawfully governs commercial and government agencies, when criminal charges are levied against government agents or individuals participating in commercial activities, or any person unlawfully trafficking in commercial activities, they must be first indicted by a common law grand jury, and then judged by a common law petit jury. An information by a U.S. attorney and a ruling by a judge is not lawful. In the essay of the trial by jury, Lysander Spooner, in Section 1, wrote, "It is the unalienable right of the people and their primary and paramount duty to judge the justice of the law, and to hold all laws invalid that are, in their opinion, unjust or oppressive, and all persons guiltless in violating or resisting the execution of such laws. Unless such be the right and duty of jurors, it is plain that instead of juries being a palladium of liberty, a barrier against the tyranny and oppression of the government, they are really mere tools in the hands for carrying into execution any injustice and oppression it may desire to have executed. But for their right to judge of the law and the justice of the law, juries would be no protection to an accused person, even as to matters of fact. For if the government can dictate to the jury any law whatever in a criminal case, it can certainly dictate to them the laws of evidence. That is, it can dictate what evidence is admissible and what inadmissible, and also what force or weight is to be given to the evidence omitted, as they do in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And if the government can thus dictate to a jury the laws of evidence, it can not only make it necessary for them to convict on a partial exhibition of the evidence rightfully pertaining to the case, but it can even require them to convict on any evidence, whatever that it pleases to offer them. That the rights and duties of juries must necessarily be such as are here claimed for them will be evident when it is considered what the trial by jury is and what is its object. The trial by jury, then, is a trial by the country, that is, by the people, as distinguished from a trial by the government. It was anciently called trial per pares, that is, trial by the country. And now, in every criminal trial, the juries are told that the accused has, for trial, put himself upon the country. Which country you are, the jury. The object of this trial, by the country, or by the people, in preference to a trial by the government, is to guard against every species of oppression by the government. In order to effect this end, it is indispensable that the people or the country judge of and determine their own liberties against the government, instead of the government judging of the determining its own powers over the people. How is it possible that juries can do anything to protect the liberties of the people against the government if they are not allowed to determine what those liberties are? Any government that is its own judge of and determines authoritatively for the people what are its own powers over the people is an absolute government, of course. It has all powers that it chooses to exercise. There is no other, or at least no more accurate definition of despotism than this. On the other hand, any people that judge of and determine authoritatively for the government what are their own liberties against the government, of course, retains all the liberties they wish to enjoy. And this is freedom. At least it is freedom to them, because although it may be theoretically imperfect, it nevertheless corresponds to their highest notions of freedom. To secure this right of the people to judge of their own liberties against the government, the juries are taken from the body of the people by lot or by some process that precludes any previous knowledge, choice, or selection of them on the part of the government. This is done to prevent the government's constituting a jury in its own partisans or friends. In other words, to prevent the government packing a jury with a view to maintain its own laws and accomplish its own purpose. It is supposed that if 12 men be taken by lot from the mass of the people without the possibility of any previous knowledge, choice, or selection of them on the part of the government, the jury will be a fair epitome of the country at large, and not merely of the party or faction that sustains the measures of the government. That substantially all classes of opinions prevailing among the people will be represented in the jury, and especially that the opponents of the government, if the government have any opponents, will be represented there, as well as its friends, that the classes who are opposed by the laws of the government, if any are thus oppressed, will have their representatives in the jury, as well as those classes who take sides with the oppressor. That is with the government. It is fairly presumable that such a tribunal will agree to no conviction except such as substantially the whole country would agree to. If they were present, taken part in the trial, a trial by such tribunal is therefore in effect a trial by the country. In its results, it probably comes as near to a trial by the whole country as any trial that it is practical to have, without too great inconveniences and expense, and as unanimity is required for a conviction, it follows that no one can be convicted except for the violation of such laws as substantially the whole country wish to have maintained. The government can enforce none of its laws by punishing offenders through the verdicts of juries, except such as substantially the whole people wish to have enforced. The government, therefore, consistently with the trial by jury, can exercise no powers over the people, or, what is the same thing, over the accused person who represents the rights of the people, except such as substantially the whole people of the country consent that it may exercise. In such a trial, therefore, the country or the people judge of and determine their own liberties against the government, instead of the government judging of and determining its own powers over the people. But all this trial by the country would be no trial at all by the country, but only a trial by the government, if the government could either declare who may and who may not be jurors, or could dictate to the jury anything whatsoever, either of law or evidence. That is the essence of the trial. If the government may decide who may and who may not be jurors, it will of course select only its partisans and those friendly to its measures. It may not only prescribe who may and who may not be eligible to be drawn as jurors, but it may also question each person drawn as a jury as to his sentiments in regard to the particular law involved in each trial, before suffering him to be sworn on the panel, and exclude him if he be found unfavorable to maintenance of such a law. So also, if the government may dictate the jury what laws they are to enforce, it is no longer a trial by the country, but a trial by the government, because the jury then try the accused not by any standards of their own, by their own judgment of their rightful liberties, but by the standards dictated to them by the government. And the standard thus dictated by the government becomes the measure of the people's liberties. If the government dictates the standard of trial, it is of course dictates the results of the trial. And such a trial is no trial by the country, but only a trial by the government. And in it, at the government determines what are its own powers over the people, instead of the people determining what are their own liberties against the government. In short, if the jury have no right to judge of the justice of a law of the government, they plainly can do nothing to protect the people against the oppression of the government, for there are no oppressions which the government may not authorize by law. The jury is also judge whether the laws are rightly expounded to them by the court. Unless any judge on this point, they do nothing to protect their liberties against the oppressions that are capable of being practiced under cover of a corrupt exposition of the laws. If the judiciary can authoritatively dictate to a jury any exposition of the laws, they can dictate to them the law itself, and such laws as they please, because laws are, in practice, one thing or another, according as they are expounded. The jury must also judge whether there really be any such law, be it good or bad, as the accused is charged with having transgressed. Unless they judge on this point, the people are liable to have their liberties taken from them by brute force without any law at all. The jury must also judge of the laws of evidence. If the government can dictate to the jury the laws of evidence, it can not only shut out any evidence it pleases, tending to vindicate the accused, but it can require that any evidence whatsoever that it pleases to offer be held as conclusive proof of any offense whatever, which the government chooses to allege. It is manifest, therefore, that the jury must judge of and try the whole case, and every part and parcel of the case, free of any dictation or authority on part of the government. They must judge of the existence of the law, of the true exposition of the law, of the justice of the law, and of the admissibility of and weight of all the evidence offered. Otherwise, the government will have everything its own way. The jury will be mere puppets in the hands of the government, and the trial will be, in reality, a trial by the government and not a trial by the country. By such trials, the government will determine its own powers over the people, instead of the people's determining their own liberties against the government. And it will be an entire delusion to talk, as for centuries we have done, of the trial by jury as a palladium of liberty, or as any protection to the people against the oppression and tyranny of the government. The question, then, between trial by jury, as thus described, and trial by the government is simply a question between liberty and despotism. The authority to judge what are the powers of the government and what liberties of the people must necessarily be vested in one or the other of the parties themselves, the government or the people, because there is no third party to whom it can be entrusted. If the authority be vested in the government, the government is absolute, and the people have no liberties except such as the government sees fit to indulge them with. If, on the other hand, that authority be vested in the people, then the people have all liberties, as against the government, except such as substantially the whole people, through a jury, choose to disclaim. And the government can exercise no power except such as substantially the whole people, through a jury, consent that it may exercise. Okay, Jan, are you here? Or Terry, are you, do you know if Jan's here?
Yeah, I'm here, Jan.
Do you have any questions, or do we have any announcements?
Yeah, we have questions, several pages. If you're ready for questions.
Yep, take a few questions.
Okay, this first one, I'm not sure if we touched on it 2 weeks ago. Last week we didn't get any of them done. It says, we are the Allegheny County Committee of Safety, and it seems like we read this one, but and we've discussed obtaining a writ of mandamus to compel county officials to conduct an election audit. How best can we obtain and present a writ of mandamus? As residents of Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, we should have standing to take legal action. Currently, 51 of the 67 counties in Pennsylvania have initiated a pursuit to seek an election audit. Are our county officials in dereliction of duty by not conducting audits when their constituents demand them? With us being a legitimate committee of safety, is there a potential for success in going about it this way? Your comments, please.
All right, well, look, at again, I don't know how far they've advanced in structuring their committee of safety. Remember, you know, there's powers in numbers, and, you know, we have government not by the majority, but we have government by the majorities who participate. And I would imagine if we can get 40, 50, 60 people in every single county, then we can control the entire state collectively. We definitely can control our local government, because we'd be in the positions to act as the committeemen. Even though we're not elected committeemen, neither are they. We have not found any elected committeemen anywhere in the United States, only facades of the election. But in any event, you know, we've proven it the past couple of quite a few years, particularly through a lot of the movements, you know, the different patriot groups that have been established over the past 15 or so years. And also with a lot of the people movement in Trump, since Trump been running for office, and a lot of people in various states that got together and started to do, for instance, out in California, they did a recall. That's the job of the committeemen. It's the job of the people. We don't have to be elected committeemen to do that. We can recall anyone we want, but we need the force to be able to do that. You need enough people in every county across that particular state in order to call back a governor, because there's a certain requirement, a certain number of papers that we have to get signed for that recall, and quite a few signatures. So we would need a lot of people, and we would need a lot of people in most every county, because you know, you can't get all the signatures in one county. You have to get a good selection within each county and collectively meet a certain number, which is a percentage of the last government, governor election, or whatever office the individual might be in. You have to get a certain percentage of the what they were elected by. You have to get a certain signed petition for recall. So we the people can start recalling, take these people out of office. Again, I don't know how far advanced they've gotten with that. That's a very important thing. They have to have clout and power and authority over the local governments, whether it be county government, town government, village government, and state government. So let's stick within a county. If you have the power and the authority with enough people to have clout and to put the fear of the people into the hearts of the individuals that are elected at the county level, and you can do so, therefore, then, if you have enough of that, you then have enough to deal with the people on the town levels and the village levels and the city levels. Then, you can take control of that. Now, moving into the courts, you're not going to get them to agree with anything that is just and right in the courts, because it would be very rare. I don't want to say it's an impossibility, but if you did move into the courts, you could get something if you get a judge that wants to give justice and is bold enough to go up against them, because he'd be going against his own people. He'd be going up against the Bar Association. He'd be going up against the powers that be, all of the esquires, the minions of the New World Order, even the state, justice, as far as the Supreme Court of the state. So there's a problem there trying to do anything in the courts, of course. But we need to be getting together to establish taking back the courts by putting together and getting people interested in taking on the position of jury administrators to prepare for those courts, so that when the plug is pulled, when the military pulls the plug and the deep state is finally taken out, that's when we move in. But we need the people. We need them in numbers. Again, and the most important individual in order to achieve any of these things you're working on is the sheriff. The sheriff is your first individual that you really want to pull in. And we've laid all this out in our handbooks. As a matter of fact, let me see if I can open up the handbook. We have, the Committee Man Handbook, Committee of Safety Handbook. Okay, here in the Committee of Safety Handbook, which is 74 pages, okay, gives very specific detail and on how to organize your Committee of Safety, all the different subcommittees that are required, so people need to be working on this, and take the authority back. We have to take control of the jury system. These prosecutors and these judges do not belong talking to our grand juries, number one, from the prosecutor's perspective, and talking to our appellate juries, trial juries, number two, from the perspective of the judge. That's jury tampering in either case. But right now, they control the juries. They stack the juries. Everything is done according to their control. They decide who gets onto the jury. We talked about this, as a matter of fact, tonight. So, again, we have to take this back. We have to take back the courts. The courts belong to the people. And the only individual in the court is really the magistrate, which is not a judge. He could be a judge, but he has to take off his judge hat and put on his magistrate hat. You know, there are individuals who are just magistrates, and there are individuals who are just judges. And every judge is a magistrate. So a judge can either make rulings and decisions in a equity court, and that could be appealed, but when he comes into a court of law, he makes no decisions, and that court is not appealable. Not even the United States Supreme Court can second guess the judgments and the decisions of a court of record, which is a court of jury, which is a court of law, a court by jury. That jury, that decision is final. There are certain exceptions to that. If someone's rights were violated in that case, then of course the Supreme Court of the land, whether it be the state Supreme Court or the federal Supreme Court, has a duty to intervene only for the protection of the injury of the individual that was violated in that through that court system, but certainly cannot overturn the decision of that case. And there might be another. Let's say if it was a murder case or something, and some evidence, science evidence was discovered that vindicated an individual. Of course, the United States Supreme Court or the state Supreme Court definitely has a duty to step in and make that correction. That's about it on the rules as far as any kind of an involvement and a decision making by any of the the state Supreme Court or the federal Supreme Court. Depending on how far they are, sometimes it's just not ready to move. There are a lot of things we'd like to do here at National Liberty Alliance and make some moves, but it would be wasting our time, because we have to first win the major battle, and that is to take control of our courts before we can do anything further than that, because that's really our main focus, is to take back the courts and to establish committees of safety. The other part of that is the militia. So you have the jury, you have the committee men, and you have the militia. And again, the committeemen, we should become elected committeemen at some point in time, but until we do become elected committeemen, we can absolutely act as the committeemen, have more power and authority than those who claim to be elected, and actually recall or put people into office, because we can make the decision then who goes on to the tickets, you know, to run for office, just by getting enough signatures for the individuals to run for. So, again, it's hard to discover where they're at, though, to say where they can go. So, all right, hopefully I covered that pretty good. Anything I was missing with that, did you think of, Jan?
That should do it, John. Okay. My next question is, when writing, filing, and sending notices, conditional acceptances, affidavits, declarations, or other documents to public officials, what should be done to fortify the documents? Should everything be notarized? I've seen some papers that just have two witness signatures. Which one should you do? Should papers be sent certified mail or registered mail? UPS, USPS, FedEx, doesn't matter. Other options like signatures required on delivery. If you're responding to a department, should you address your letter to the department as a whole or an individual within the department? What else should I be aware of? Just starting to learn these things, and I don't know what I don't know.
Well, any communications that I have with government that's personal, I do that by affidavit. And everything is certified. You don't have to have return slip, because if you do it certified, a couple of days after you do the certified, you go up, trace the number out, and you can see a copy of the signature, because that still has to be signed for. Or you can spend the extra couple of bucks and get the green card returned with the signature on it. But either way, you get the signature from the post office by going through, going online and running that certified number. So that covers you on that. But especially with the IRS, I do have, and again, any government that I deal with, I do certified, and I do affidavit. Even local courts, I talk to them all in affidavit form. Now, from the grand jury perspective, once we put a signature and a seal on it, we're honorable. We don't need to certify anything. Our seal and our signature is the certification and the honor of that signature and the words spoken in that paper. But even with that, we do, I know with paperwork, because they love to lose paperwork, at least with that, I do the certified, even into the courts. We don't care too much about the other individuals, because we're honorable. If we put it into the courts, they have it. And the way the court systems go now, they're notified by the court system anyway to some degree, and they're supposed to go up and check their paperwork, so they get it. But we're honorable. We are doing what we're saying we're doing, and we're writing things, and we're honest and honorable. We better be as jurists. So, again, when we operate from that perspective, it's a different story. And we shouldn't have to certify to the courts, but they are not honorable. They're controlled by evil. They're created by evil. They have hijacked our courts. They have destroyed our republic. The entire integrity of our court is been destroyed by these judges within these courts, because they have just gotten rid of common law, and they don't even hide that fact. I've been told by judges, common law has been abrogated. You can't bring that up. I mean, oh really? I mean, that's how ignorant they are, and that's how they are indoctrinated in their bar teachings, to think that they can break a covenant between we the people and our Creator, and then we the people being now the king by the authority of God invested in us to ordain and establish this Constitution to control them, not only on the federal level, but in every state of the Union. We are a natural law republic, and the only one, and second only to the other one that was 3,600 years ago. 3,600? Let me see, about 1,600 B.C. So, yeah, about 3,600 years ago was the first natural law republic, and we here, in these last couple of hundred years, is the second. to have a covenant with God. And that's the Declaration of Independence, by the way. That's a covenant with God. Read through it very carefully, anybody who hasn't, and you'll see we're looking to be under the blessings of God. And he reestablished that in the preamble to the Constitution, that part of the government's job is to protect the blessings of liberty, to make sure that liberty is protected by government that has been blessed and bestowed upon us by God himself. And the Declaration of Independence, if you look through it, Jefferson spoke about it, and you can look through it and see very clearly that he spoke about 8 ancient principles that came out of the Bible, the first 5 books of the Bible, and established that relationship just like Israel did with God. We did so too. Those 8 principles are found in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. So it's not debatable anymore. But in any event, these people think that they can just, get rid of it. And as Jefferson said, God's judgment is not going to wait forever. You don't come and violate these are outsiders. These people are evil. You can't come and violate an outsider coming to violate a relationship between God's people and God. And all those who are happy to live within that kind of the republic. You can't expect to violate that without not meeting the wrath of God at some point in time. And I think we're very close to that point in time. So, okay, next question.
Okay. Article 4.
By the way, is Brent here tonight? Anybody seen Brent?
I have not. I just started looking for him when you called me, and I didn't see him.
Right. Well, Terry can keep an eye out.
I haven't seen him yet.
Right.
Article 4, Section 4, consists of one clause, provided that the federal government shall guarantee a republican form of government to all states, providing courts of justice under the law of the land, a.k.a. common law. But I cannot find the reference to the common law in Article 4, Section 4. Would you please send me the reference?
Well, yeah, the word law is common law. You'll find that in numerous places. You'll also find in Article 3, Section, Section 1, the judicial power of the United States. This is Article 3, Section 1, one article before it. Article 3, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time to ordain and establish. The judges of the Supreme Courts shall hold their offices during good behavior and shall stated times receive their services, so on and so forth. Then in Section 2 it says the judicial power shall extend in all cases in law and equity. Law is common law. There is where equity is really legislative law. It's also referred to as positive law, but it is laws made by man and not by God. If you go into Black's Law or Bouvier's Law dictionaries, you will discover the word law, in law, at law, is all referenced to common law. So there are only two types of law, okay? There is the two types of lawful law, let's put it that way, only two. There is law, common law, God's law, written in the hearts of men. It's so obvious to everyone, the law, when you sit in the courtroom and listen, it's obvious if there was an injury, and it's obvious on how one might try to restore that, if possible, and or at least compensate. So there's law. And then there's equity, and the only lawful equity in this world, the only lawful equity is law that is given by the people and ultimately who have a relationship with their creator, and again, a covenant that we have, Declaration of Independence, and that's a lawful structure. Now, all other governments are acting under civil law, manly law, Babylonian law, okay? Babylonian law is the law of the city, it's the law of the municipality, it's also referred to as Justinian law or Roman law. If you ask any lawyer, almost every one of them will tell you, oh, we're under Roman law. they have no clue or understanding what they're saying. They just don't understand. Again, that gets back to civil law, man-made law. It's not positive law. It's not lawful law. It's law by a group of individuals who wants to control the populace. It's that simple. And it was hidden over time. You know, again, they tried to refer to Babylonian law as a lawful equity. For instance, they changed the name to hide it, and they called it, it's just repackaged in Justinian law and also in Roman law, but Justinian law particularly, and say that it was equitable and good and so on. No, it's not good. If it's not controlled by the people, it's not good. Again, we just looked at trial by jury by Lysander Spooner, section 1 of his essay. And we just read through that, and we saw how clearly that if the people are not in control of the law by deciding the law, when do the people get the chance to decide the law? Look, we've given authority to the legislators by Article 1 of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, I believe it is. Let me double check. 8 or 9? Yeah, it's 8. Section 8. We've given them 17 powers. We've given them the authority to write legislation in certain areas, controlling commercial activities and government agencies. And they responded with 57, I believe it was, codes. And each one of those codes have a focus on government or commercial activity. And it's all lawful. But sometimes the things that they put in there are unlawful or not desirable or liked by the people. So when it comes to play in a courtroom, for a fully informed jury, which we intend to have at some point in time, because right now we don't, and that's why we wrote the book, the handbook, so that we can have fully informed juries to really understand the powers and authorities of we the people, you the people sitting on this jury. You're the judge. You're sitting on the king's bench. You are representing God's will in justice and righteousness. That's what it's all about. And that's what common law teaches. And so we get to decide whether we like that law or not. It might be a good law, but not in this case. That's what the jury can decide. I think that's a good law, but it doesn't work here. It just doesn't work in this case for whatever reason, and we nullify it. Forget about it. It's not here. Or they make their own law on the spot, right there. You're the lawmaker. And then through that, you discover innocence or guilt, period. And the only time equity plays a role in a common law court, a court of record, is when an individual who is operating under commercial activities or in certain agencies and are accused of a crime as they're acting within those agencies or during their commercial activities, and a grand jury agrees with that that's a crime, they've committed a crime, And so they indict, and then they go before a petit jury for the trial, and the trial jury listens and makes the decisions, and they do consider whether they like to use that law or not, whether they think it's a fair, just law or not. And if we the people don't do that, then we're not protecting our liberties. Again, we saw that clearly. That's how we prevent the government from abusing the people and from abusing you, us, we the people, all of us. Our founding fathers experienced this early on in the colonies. By God's mercy, they had the common law courts far more better than what was going on in England. Remember, a lot of people had come over, 50 years and 100 years. They were already born here, some of them, in America. But their parents came or their grandparents came. And they came with the common law. So it was well established in the colonies. Although the king, trying to control it, was sending his esquires, which are like knights, his esquires, to control the people through civil law and trying to impress within our courts civil law. And thankfully, in our courts, many of our courts within the colonies, our founding fathers wouldn't have it. And so when the king went up against somebody and tried to bring them into the courts, they wouldn't get an indictment because the people refused to indict. And that's why they used to capture them and take them to England to get their indictment and try them there. And that's where we're at again now. We're there right now. We are brought into jurisdictions unknown and assaulted in their courts. And unless the people step up and take back control of our courts, remember, the people get to decide the facts, they get to decide the law, and they get to decide the punishment. The state can suggest whatever they want, and we can ignore them, or we can consider that and say, hey, that might be a good idea. But ultimately, it's up to the people. We're the lawmakers. Right there and then, we create the law. Innocence or guilt, we create the law that applies that against these individuals or not. And we apply what we think is a fair justice judgment upon the individual that has been accused. So, but the word law anywhere in the Constitution, and right here clearly, is the only two laws that apply within the United States, law and equity. And even equity, though, even equity law, our legislators are to be operating and writing law under American jurisprudence. And our judges are to enforce that law, that legislation, under American jurisprudence. And that's the science of government. It brings us right back to common law under the rules of common law. And the rules of common law, ultimately, it's common sense. It's building of maxims, principles that cannot be denied, maxims that cannot be denied, common sense that cannot be denied. All pretty much the same thing. So, law is clearly there. So, next question.
This is a response sent by a member to a question about the flag that comes up every year or two. It says, President Dwight David Eisenhower, by executive order number 10834, signed on August 21st, 1959, and printed in the Federal Register at 24FR6865, pursuant to law, stated that a military flag is a flag that resembles the regular flag of the United States, except it has a yellow fringe border on three sides. And that question comes up from time to time, so I thought I'd just hand that over. Okay. The next question then is, of these listed taxes, how many of them are constitutionally lawful? First is sales tax, wage tax, property
unlawful.
Tax, inheritance tax, and per so capita.
Oh, I'm not getting it. What was the third one? Inheritance? What was the third one?
How many of these taxes are constitutionally lawful, for example.
Yeah, I know, but as you're reading, I'm going to give an answer, then I'll talk about them. So just say one at a time. First one is the sales tax. That's lawful. Next.
Okay, wage tax.
Unlawful, because that's direct tax. No direct tax lawful in the Constitution. No direct tax shall be applied. Look ahead. Unlawful.
Property tax.
Direct tax. Unlawful.
Inheritance tax.
Direct tax, unlawful.
Per capita or head tax?
Lawful only if it is equal to every individual in the state and paid by the state, not by the individual. The state has to figure a way to collect lawful taxes in order to apply that capitation tax, and has to be applied. Let's say there's 100,000 people. I mean, any state has a lot more than that, but I'm just taking a number. Let's say there's 100,000 people. You say we want $1 for every head. Well, then they have to come up with $100,000 in taxes. But the federal government can apply that upon the state on a capitation tax on the individuals or the population within the state. But again, the state has to find a way to collect that tax without it being a direct tax. They could do it through sales tax and various other lawful taxes, but mostly the sales tax. Go ahead. Is there any other taxes they got?
Nope, that was all the taxes. Yeah.
Direct tax is something that, again, they cannot apply at all. And I believe that's in, Article 1, Section 9, I think. Let me just see if I can find it real quick. Here it is. Article 1, Section 9, paragraph 4. No capitation or direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. So you see, you can't put a taxation on an individual's head. If 100,000 people want everyone to give us a dollar, you can't do that. So that's a capitation tax. or the direct tax. That's a direct taxation tax. Or a direct tax. Tax on property, tax on salary, all that is a direct tax. You can't do it. Shall be laid unless in proportion to the census. So the census comes around, there's 100,000 people in the state, and the federal government wants every state to give a certain amount of money from every state to the federal government. and it's done by count, is done by the census, and then it's taken through some lawful tax by the state to deliver to the federal government. So any tax upon your labor, your sweat, anything you own, with the exception of sales tax, once you buy it once, you own it. Or why should property be any different? Once you buy it once, you own it. Why are you going to keep paying every year for a tax on that? That's crazy. Well, that's all unlawful, and it's also a slave tax. It's a tax on the sweat of the brow. Okay, next question.
Okay. How, let's see, let's do this.
By the way, if anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue, if you have any questions or comments. Okay.
Can a man or male, or a woman, female, be forced into a contract with a corporation, which is fiction, like all corporate governments?
Well, the key word is forced. Of course, you can't be forced. And if there's no meeting of the mind, you can't have some kind of relationship or a contract with anyone if there's no meeting of the mind. And I know a lot of the things that were done on the federal level and even the state level, I pull the people in, just for the fact they claim to be born or something, and they get a number or Social Security, and all of a sudden now you get this agreement. No, there was no meeting of the minds, number one. So there is no agreement. It's all fraud. That's all that is. When you bring up corporations, it's very interesting and really absurd. What's in the news right now that we heard, I think it was last week, that they're going to release, the information on indictments against an individual with the Trump organization, and it says that that individual was indicted, and it says the individual and the Trump organization, which is a corporation, okay? The Trump corporation was indicted. You can't indict a corporation. That is absurd. Even in their own laws, you can't do it. You cannot indict a corporation. But I'm sure what it is that's just the news from the New York Times. I think they were the ones that released that information and set the indictment. So they just tagged in the individual, and they indicted the Trump organization. But that has got to be a lie straight from hell. But if it's not, then it should really, I've never heard of anything. You cannot indict a corporation. That's ridiculous. But anyway, then.
Okay, that was the last question, John.
Okay, any announcements?
No, not really.
Terry, have you found Brent? Being the fourth weekend, he may not be in. No? Okay. All right, I guess we'll go to Q&A. If anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1. We only got a couple people there. And we'll just start taking some questions right now. Kevin, you're the first one in the queue. I have a feeling I know what you're going to ask, but go right ahead, Kevin.
Yep, John, you're absolutely right. Government guy consent book. Still looking for that book and waiting for it. It's paid for.
Okay, well, you were here last week, and we did reveal the fact that I put all my final John Hancocks on all of the necessary material. They sent me a book. And I believe I had it last week. I got it, I think, right before the weekend last week. And on Monday, I announced the fact that I got the book. I've been looking at the book quite a bit. I'm very, very happy with the book. I feel a lot better about the book than I was before I, was waiting for it to come back, in the sense that, it flows pretty good. I'm just happy with all the information and everything's in there. I have so much more to say, but it couldn't make the book. And again, I'm working on a second book already. I'm working on papers concerning, as I mentioned earlier, the Bar Association and the federal judiciary and the United States Supreme Court being part of the federal judiciary. So I'm doing a lot of writing on that and the jury and the powers and the authorities of the jury and all the violations for papers. And at the same time, I'm putting these things into kind of book form, so I'll be coming up with another book. And I'll also be adding on to the jurist book, which we looked at a little bit a few minutes ago, which I think, what was that, the jurist handbook, yeah, has 30 pages. It's probably going to go up another 10 or 15, maybe more, pages, but great information. And, you know, I think when I finish with that book, and I hope to finish that book really this week and get it updated. Right now you can download that book. It's 30 pages. But when I think by next Monday I'll have the update on that, and we'll have an updated one with probably 40, 45, maybe even 50, maybe even more pages. But the key thing to that book, what I wanted to get into that book, was really to make sure that we do have a 100%, not 99, one, hopefully it's going to be a 100% fully informed jury. If every jurist gets that book and ponders the information and the research put into that book with much, much documentation on where that information come from to declare the facts as being truth. This is not, you know, words on a page that has no power, no clout, no authority. No, this is powerful, has clout, and has full 100% authority. So when they finish with that book and then they go to do their job as a grand or petit jury, and therein is the orientation, by the way. I'm going to put together some things for the orientation to really make sure that our jurists get it. And this handbook will be, of course, one of the tools of that each jurist should get and should reference to throughout their case and their time as a grand or trial jury. And when they have, idle time or something. Obviously, you can't read a paper or a book or anything while you're in a courtroom, but you certainly can, having idle time, you certainly can read that book, that handbook. That's what they do with the federal handbook, and, people are supposed to refer to it. And that just brings them into subjection of a slavery situation where they use that to stack and control the juries. But anyway, with that being said, there is another book coming out. But I did at the end of the week on Friday, on Thursday, I called the individual who is now responsible for taking the job from taking my book into the next step, okay, which is to get it to print. There's an actual, small little committee that's working that out to push it into print. And I did call them up. I did not get them on the phone. And I believe it was at the end of the day, Thursday. And they didn't get back to me Friday, and we have a holiday weekend, so I'll be calling them again tomorrow because I wanted to make sure that they got the message that this is supposed to be a fast-paced book. We're a year into it. I was looking at dates on when I started this, and we're just about a year into it. We started it in June. We're a little over a year. We've moved into July now. So, but I started this procedure with them in June of last year, and I impressed upon them the necessity to move this book forward quickly, and they said that they would, and yet we were looking at 6 months or so, roughly eight at the most, and here we are, 12, moving into 13, and we're now just moved into the point where it has moved to print. So, I'm hoping that what the other people told me, I haven't spoke to the individuals actually physically, that is the group that handles that, but the last group told me that once it moves into print that it would be 3 weeks. And if that is correct, we're in the second week now. So let's see. I'm trying to remember when I got the book. I got it before last week. I think I got it on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. But the day I got that book, I breezed through it really quickly and approved it. So we're 1 week in, let's say. This will be coming this week, through this week will be 2 weeks, and another week will be 3 weeks. And if they're you know, if they're accurate, that group is accurate, then in 2 more weeks it should be out to print. And I'm dying to get that book out, because not only do I want to deliver that book to the individuals who bought those books, I have a list of individuals I want to get a copy of the book to for the sole purpose of gaining an interview so that we can get this out onto the market. And anybody that can think of anybody that has a high following, you know, like Valuetainment, I don't know if familiar, how many people are familiar with Valuetainment. Patrick is the guy who put that together and is an individual who interviews lots of, he looks one of the best interviewers I've ever seen. Anyways, this guy is one of the best. And I want to be interviewed by him, and he's got millions of followers. So if I can get interviewed by someone like him and anybody else that anyone else can think that should get a book to get that information to Jan at NationalLibertyAlliance.org or Francine at NationalLibertyAlliance.org, and Jan will get that information to Francine, and Francine will work on that to get that into the list. You know, she'll share that with me first before she does that. We do have a list of quite a few people we want to get a copy of the book to so that we can really get moving. Now, these people are supposed to be contacting me also on their strategy of moving my book into the bookstore and potentially into libraries and so on and so forth. But we'll see where all that goes. But I'm not going to wait for them. I'm moving forward without them. So I think if we hit the right people, we'll get it quick. But that's where we're at, Kevin. I'm hoping in 2 more weeks the books will be here. Matter of fact, I talked with Francine just today, earlier today, and I told her let's double up on. Matter of fact, I'm glad you brought this up because I forgot to drop the information to Francine. I'm going to redrop her all of the papers I have for these books so that they can check through them and make sure they got them all. But I want to get that list together before the end of the week, if possible, and start printing out the labels, you know, over the weekend. And I've already got the packaging for the books to go out on. So if I can print out all the labels and get all the packages labeled and ready to go, so when the books come in, I can just slide them into each sleeve and get them all out in the next day, let's say. So we'll move them as quick as we can, as quick as we get them, and I'll be annoying them as much as you've been annoying me, Kevin. But I'll be annoying them a hell of a lot more, believe me.
Okay, I did hear out of all of that answer, you did say 2 more weeks. I heard you say it.
And remember, those are not my knowledge now.
2 more weeks, John. I heard you say it. I'm waiting for those 2 more weeks, and I won't bother you until then. Thank you.
That's okay. I like to be bothered anyway, because it does get the word out to people who wasn't here last week. They're here this week, maybe, and maybe next week other people will hear it. So I don't mind it. But, you know, I do want to impress the fact is this is my first time around this corner here. You know, I have never published a book before. This is my first book. I've had no experience. I've learned a lot, and I don't want to say if I'm ever going to do it again. I'm going to say when I do it again, I'm going to do it a lot different, and I'm going to have a lot more control. And you know, I should have known better to really look a little harder into the contract and put more words of my words into that contract, because the contract is a meeting of minds, and I should have put certain things pushed into the contract. And I, you know, which would have held their feet to the fire, and I could have been suing them at this point and held them liable at this point, because they did not fulfill what words we spoke out, you know, that they would do, but I didn't push it into the contract. That won't happen to me again for that. And next time it will be done on schedule. You know, my career, I'm a construction manager. That's my trade, and I've got lots of trades involved with construction management and general contracting. And meeting deadlines is everything. You don't meet a deadline, there's a penalty to pay, you know, because other people that have to come and build upon the work that maybe a framer puts in, they're looking to come in and they're planning their jobs, and they get injured. Or if they screw up something, you know, they have to fix it, and someone else built the work upon it, they got to pay for it to be taken back out and put back in again. So you know, timing is very important, and I really feel that this book had an important timing, and I really wish it would have been done earlier. But on the other hand, with all that said, I do believe God's in charge, and we're right on time. So, thanks, Kevin.
Excellent. Two more weeks. Thank you very much, John. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anybody else wants to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1? We only got two people in the queue, star 6 and a 1. We'll take our next caller, Asula. Is that how I pronounce that? I recognize you, Asula, right?
Hey, John.
How you doing?
Hello.
Hello. Go right ahead, Asula.
Yes, I... This is Asuna from Missouri.
Yep.
And I, you know, was wanted to find out if, you know, I, if I can, if there's anybody that, you know, take donations for help on my default.
Mm-hmm. So you have a default, and what is it you want? Donations?
You know, the somebody that can help me with my default, and you know, I just keep donating.
Well, you know, the thing, it's tough, a lot of people have a certain amount of information, but not necessarily enough. But then others do have others. I mean, you know, you could talk with Brent, maybe he can assist you, and you know, and he takes donations.
Brent
Allen Winters, you know.
Oh.
You know, and he's a common law lawyer, and if he can assist you, and you know, you give him a few dollars to help you out or so,
okay.
I can assist as much as I can really on the program here, and to some degree on the phone, but really, you know, when you're going into a default, if you're at the point where you have a default, explain that, and maybe I can help you a little bit. You've got you filed papers, you served them correctly, you did a motion or a notice of motion, X amount of days went by and they didn't answer. Is that the case?
Right.
How many days went by?
We were talking last week. You know, I asked the question because the attorney, they referred the tax from Kansas to the attorney to collect that, but the amount changed again. So I said, you know, then we were talking about that. I was going to send the affidavit to produce the proof of claim, which is gone. I sent it out on the 30th. So I gave him like 20 days to respond on that.
I think we spoke about, did you put a notice of motion on the front cover of those pages?
Of the affidavit?
Yeah, when you're expecting an answer on something, okay, now, you know, when it goes back and forth, if you're working back and forth, paper to paper, they go, you go, they go, you go, you know, it's one back and forth, but when you're making... a demand on something, you're going to want to move the court to do something about it. So if you filed the papers to them and they haven't responded, the next step, okay, is to motion the court to require that to take place. And if after 20 days or whatever you allot on that motion, once you motion the court, you know, 20 days is sufficient once you're in court, then you do the notice of motion. With the final, you know, movement of the court to require them to do something, and if they don't do something, then you can then default them. Then you have to give them a notice of default, okay? And that you file with the clerk, and you also get those papers certified, and you take them down to the sheriff, and you go collect, off of your wherefore clause.
Okay.
But, you know, but it's not again, I don't understand where you are in the case. The fact that they didn't respond doesn't mean that you can file a... let me think about that. Let me think a minute. Because you're in court. You see, the problem is the judges are protecting them. That's what's happening. And they're just sitting back and just not doing nothing or saying anything. I would move the court to demand that this papers be filed with the court or they are in default. That's what I would do. And you got into court because you sued them or they sued you?
So I would, I need to do a motion to...
Well, let me first ask the question first. Did they sue you, you're in court, or you sued them?
We're not in court yet. They just keep sending me the same, the same letter, and a different person every time.
Okay.
And so
right,
now
you're actually not in court right now.
No.
Okay, so you're at a standstill where they shouldn't be able to move or do anything. I would send them one more letter and notify them that you're going to go after them for fraud if they try to pursue or push anything without a proof of claim. And a proof of claim is what is required to open up a court and to proceed in a court of law. And if they proceed in a court of law without that affidavit of a proof of claim, okay, and that judge
right.
lets them go through, then that's collusion. That's conspiracy, and there's a crime on two parties that come together to defraud you. That's the point when you can go after them. So you're really at a point really where you kind of should let them know, you demand that they respond to you and let you know whether there is a proof of claim, which is, I think that's the Form 56,
Right.
And 4490, I believe, is the fiduciary. If they got their proof of claim, I want to see it. And,
right.
to let them know, you try to move this into a court without that sworn affidavit proof of claim, I will go after you criminally. And you do that in an affidavit and let it sit. But it is true. Every time they write you a letter, you got to respond to everything because they're building. First of all, they're building a court case against you by writing letters. That's where it all starts. Okay, that's how the IRS does it. And you're building the court case right back against and defending yourself by responding to every single thing they say. And
right.
if they say the same thing again, just let it be known. Hey, look, if you're sending me a second letter, there's nothing different. My response is the same. Attach the copy here on two, period. And you send them a copy. And you certify it. Make sure you get it certified. And then you go up online after a few days and you download the signatures. Or you certify it with the green card. Spend a couple of bucks and the green card will come back to you in the mail. Make sure you do both. That you get the certified paper and that you do everything in an affidavit form. Remember, you're swearing to everything you're saying and doing, so you're going to be held liable. Make sure what you say is accurate. So.
Right.
But you're not going to be able to default them that way. You can only default them in the court. You can do a notice and demand and default them and bring them into court. You can get information on a website about doing a notice and demand. I believe there are 8 points to a notice and demand, and you got to cover each one of them. And there's an example up there, which the original example I got off of, what's his name? Can't think of his name, the common law guy. Anyway, we got some information from him, and then I wrote my own. And put it up there so you can get that information, which covers all 8 points. Now, when you do that and you serve them notice, you're also telling them within that notice and demand that if they don't respond and do what has to be done, then this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take control. I'm going to put it into a language that we can appreciate and understand a little easier. But I'm going to take control of this whole thing, and I'm going to decide for you in a court of law. And so when they default off that, then you can take them into the court for defaulting on that. But again, it depends on what it is. Now, the lawyer is chasing you for what?
For the same amount, cancel, turn it over to him.
A state tax or a mortgage tax or what?
Yeah, it was the amount that they say that I received. I did not, and it's the state that's come, that wants
so
to.
So some kind of state tax?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'll tell you what. You just keep your paperwork going and sort of ignore it. You're not going to be able to really chase them too much, but you can get them for annoying you and move them into courts for that and demand restitution for that. But, again, you could do that through the notice and demand. But do keep in following back up with their letters. I don't think they're ever going to go anywhere. I have not seen a state take anyone to court yet. Not that they haven't done it, and I don't know all the cases out there, but I've been involved with it, and I haven't seen them do it to me or anyone else where the state comes out to try to collect their taxes. Because the whole system is set up where the federal government comes and collects the taxes ultimately. The states will ride their coattails, so to speak, and hammer you right after they do it, and if you pay them out of fear, they'll take it, and if you don't, I haven't heard of a case where they actually take you to court, because they know, and I think they have more fear, and they're not structured well enough as the IRS is structured. They're not empowered as the IRS is empowered, and so on. So.
Yeah. I sent him the, I sent him the proof of claim too. So, the 56 and 4490 attorney. So, and also sent with the affidavit, notice of demand.
Well, I will tell you, you see the problem. Here's the major problem. It's in the federal courts. The federal courts will allow, the IRS particularly, to come into a court without a sworn affidavit and open the case and go out after you in jurisdictions unknown, the civil law court. And they will permit that. Okay? On the state level, I don't think that that's as easily said as done, because the pressure upon the judges at that level, I don't see it. And therefore, they're not going to get protected by the judge. They're going to try to open a case in a state court because it's a state issue. And the court should push it back, responding, where's your sworn affidavit? You can't open up a court case without a sworn affidavit. Where is it? Got to get your proof of claim here, buddy. You see that? Right. I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Okay. I mean, I've been answering everything that they sent me so far, but
send it again.
Okay.
Tell them send it again and send it by email, too, and give me an email or something, or a fax or whatever.
Okay. So should I just wait on default until they respond, or see what they're going to come out with it?
Well,
or?
You're not going to be able to do anything with a default because you're not in court, and the only way you can default them outside of a court is with a notice and demand, and then you default them, and then you're going to pull them into court to collect off that default. And show in court, show why a judgment shouldn't be taken against them. And you lay out all the papers. But again, you have to cover 8 points, I believe it is. And you will find those 8 points up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, under education.
Okay.
Court access information.
I think I sent that already to Kansas, and, they didn't, they just send the same thing, and...
They ignore you, and when they fail to speak, when they have a duty to speak, it's fraud, and I'd let them know that too. By the way, buddy, I have spoken to you. You're not answering me, and you have a duty to speak, because the particular lawyer is representing the state here, is claiming to represent the state. So hey, it's probably the Attorney General's office, I presume, and hey, buddy, you have a duty to speak. Especially
right.
If it's the Attorney General and that's an elected office, you have a duty to speak. I responded to you, and I'm talking with you about a legal thing, and you're trying to use the law to press upon me on something, to leverage this or to leverage that, to get something out of me that I don't owe you, and I'm responding back to you, and you are not responding back to me with the things that are required by law for you to have, and that is fraud.
Mm-hmm.
When they have a duty to speak, it's fraud.
Yeah, the attorney is not the Attorney General. He's the collection attorney, so...
Then that isn't even anything. Again, they play games, and then that's another problem. Look, they'll try to hit you up with a credit. This is a different kind of issue now. They're coming out here trying to injure your credit. And if you're concerned about credit and you want credit, there is a process. I haven't learned it, and one day I might go learn it, but I just don't have the time right now. But there is a process. You see.
Yeah, I think I got it.
When these agencies that lay out your credit and give you credit scores, when they put marks against you and they say, oh, there's a collection now for this and there's this and that and the other thing and so on and so forth, you can shut them all down and make them remove all that stuff because it's all unlawful. And there's a process to do that. I'm not skilled in it, but I doubt it's very complex. You just have to learn about it. I'm trying to think.
I might have something on that.
When Gerard's on, you know, pick his mind because I think he had a course on that he had did.
Okay.
I don't remember. I think he had something on that. So
I should just wait and see what they respond with then.
Yeah, that's all you really can do because it's just a collecting, like you say, it's a collecting agency ultimately. It's a lawyer writing on behalf of the agency. They've taken over the debt. They probably gave the states a few bucks. You know, they buy these debts and then they come out after you. They destroy your credit by pressing you. And again, you can have all that erased if you go through it. There are people actually will charge you maybe $500 to go out and take care of it. But you got to be careful because there's a lot of people out there that rip off. I know someone who did this and they gave the person money and then and they never returned the calls no more. So be careful.
That's true. Thank you, John. I appreciate it. And thank you, guys. You are awesome. So God bless you all.
Thanks for calling. All right, before we move on to any other callers, Brent's here. Is that what you're calling me for, Terry? Okay. All right, Brent, you hearing me? You got your mic open? Does he have his mic open?
No, he's muted himself. I don't know that I can open that.
Okay, hello. Brent, you go. Okay, Brent, we're going to pass over to you in a minute, all right?
All right.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back to Q&A after Brent finishes up. Brent Winters is the author of The Common Excellence of the Common Law by Brent Allen Winters. He's a common law lawyer. His website is commonlawyer.com, and Brent is going to take the mic for a while. Brent, go right ahead.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I haven't been here in a few weeks, but I received a message from one of the listeners here on the NLA call, and I want to make a comment about it, and it had to do with critical race theory and critical legal theory, et cetera. Critical everything these days, and the universities have made a big deal about what we today call critical race theory. You hear about that some, but you also hear about critical legal theory. And if I talk about one of those critical theory areas of academia, I'm talking about all of it. So this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And my comments are my own, not necessarily the viewpoint of anybody else that may or may not be on this call, but I do want to talk a little bit about critical legal theory. Now, critical legal theory and critical race theory and critical this and critical that ad infinitum, ad nauseum, are, to use a term of technical legal art, are nothing but glorified hogwash. And I don't say that lightly. I say that with precision and many years of struggle over such ridiculousness. Now, when the academic world wants to buffalo other people, and that's what they do, no question, that's what they do, that's part of their supposed method of operation. When they want to buffalo people, they attach fancy words to things that are long and laborious Latin-sounding words like critical legal studies. That sounds really important, doesn't it? Sounds really highfalutin. And even the word science itself appeared on the scene of the English tongue for that very purpose. The word science is a silly word to even use anywhere. It's not part of our English tongue. We don't need it. All it means is knowledge. That's all it means. Scienter. But about 1840-something, it was introduced to impress people and make people think that this particular area of knowledge is special. And it gives us knowledge that is greater than all other knowledge. And it was meant, of course, to overcome, watch this, fact. Just fact. The way things are, and ain't going to change. But we now have, they said, the assured results of scientific investigation. What does that mean? Well, that's a fancy way of saying we got the assured results of knowledge, but they attach that word, and what then they put to it is not facts. And I'm getting back to this critical race theory, critical legal theory. They don't put facts to it. No, they rely upon logic. Logic. Sometimes they'll rely upon logic built on statistics. Matter of fact, critical race theory is all about statistics, as is critical legal theory is all about statistics. That's contrary to friends, neighbors, and kin. That's contrary to our way of life as Americans. It's contrary to our common law tradition, which is unique to us in the English-speaking world. It's contrary to our law of the land, which is another word for our common law. It's contrary to due process, which is another word for our common law, another phrase, centuries old. It's upside down to put logic before facts. William Blackstone says in his first volume of his commentaries on the laws of England, oft called his commentaries on the common law, he says in the first volume that to put the decretals of the Pope of Rome before logic is upside down and contrary to our common law. Well, that's right. And most all the world is under the law of the city, as you've heard me say before. Most all of the world is under the law of the city. And the law of the city puts logic before fact. That's upside down. Professor Merriman of Bolt Hall at the law school there at University of California in Berkeley, he's gone now, he said that when you stress logic, facts have a way of receding from consideration. Well, let's cite one of the fellow who's more famous than me and probably knows a lot more, a big-time professor. He got his head screwed on straight, finally. His name was C.S. Lewis from Britain. C.S. Lewis. He said that our problem isn't that our logic is wrong or that we've even failed to be logical. The great disagreements among men are disagreements about fact, just fact. When you go to an Inquisition in France, Germany, South America, Japan, Vietnam, Russia, all the communist countries, you go to an Inquisition, they don't have trials, because they're law of the city countries. They have Inquisitions. When you go there, they'll use logic to try to get to the truth. They don't really care if they get to the truth. They just care, of course, that the government always gets its cut. That's all that really matters. The will of the government must prevail. When you go to trial, we don't have inquisitions. In our common law tradition, we have trials. When you go there, you just ask the jury a couple of questions. I suppose really the foremost question you ask them is, what are the facts? Who done it? Why did he do it? Where did he do it? With what did he do it? Just the facts, said, remember Joe Friday? Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. That's all we want. We don't want logic. What's an affidavit? An affidavit, what is testimony on the witness stand? Well, both of those are not logic. They're not laying long, labored lengths of reasoning out for like straws in line for winds to whirl about. No, that's not it. Well, that's what critical legal theory is. Remember, it says theory, critical race theory. It's all about logic. I said, it's nothing new. No, they're talking about it like, oh, this is a new thing coming down the pike. How are we going to deal with this? We've got to have arguments against it. No, we don't. We got the facts. We've always had the facts. Stubborn things, they don't change. It is what it is. I don't care what your logic is. You're not going to change the reality of what happened or the way things are, and they ain't going to change. The law is a matter of fact, too. If it's the true law, it's the way things are, and it's not going to change. Well, all of this crept into our legal tradition here in America, this critical legal theory. And then critical race theory is just an application of the same upside-down silliness and stupidity to a different area of thought. It all amounts to nothing but scholasticism. Scholasticism is the foundation of Islam. Scholasticism is also the foundation of Talmudic Judaism. Scholasticism is also the foundation of Romanism. All three of them, in their modern form, came forth at the same time from the same source. The Islamic sage from North Africa, by the name of Averroes, introduced, he was contemporary with Thomas Aquinas, and the greatest, most well-known rabbi in Europe of all time, Mohammedes. And those three men have given to us in the Western world this awful scourge called scholasticism. Averroes got it from Plato and Aristotle. He introduced the writings of Plato and Aristotle, Greek logic, as though we didn't know how to think before the Greeks showed up. Nothing new. It's just a different label. Critical legal theory is a different label of slapped onto a corpse. A corpse drug out of the graves by the ears and then danced about it like witch doctors. They dance about it as though it's new and novel. No, it's just an old dead corpse that never was alive. Put a three-piece suit on it. That seems to be the fashionable thing now. Prop it up and dance about it as though it's new and novel, like a bunch of banshees. And that's what they're doing. And that's what they've always done. They're not going to stop doing it. They're going to keep slapping new labels on the same old filthy stuff to distract you and waste your time. Well, how was it introduced into the American legal tradition? Well, people like to point back to the year 1908. 1908. A brief was filed in the Supreme Court of the United States. It wasn't like any brief that had ever been filed in a court in America before, or any common law court in England or Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Belize, any other part of the Roman Empire where the common law prevailed. No brief like it. 1908, filed by a fellow that became a Supreme Court Justice of the United States. His name was Brandeis. Louis Brandeis filed what is now called the Brandeis Brief. And if you file a brief like that today in a court, they'll say you filed a Brandeis Brief. Well, what's a Brandeis Brief? Well, he was in the Supreme Court. He filed the brief. He was a lawyer arguing the case. And he had about 2 pages of legal authority and about 200 pages of statistical studies. Psychobabble, he added that in there too. Of course, most statistical studies include psychobabble. The conclusions of the shrinks, some people call them psychiatrists. What's a psychiatrist? And more silliness. What is a psychiatrist? A psychiatrist is a man or a woman that claims to study the psyche of man. The psyche. What's the psyche? Well, That's a word taken from the Greek tongue, taken from the Greek New Testament, psuche, usually translated soul. Soul, not spirit. That's different. That's pneuma. Soul. Well, what's the soul? Well, the soul is what all living critters have. All animals or people that are animal-like, like us, we have a soul. What is it? It is the breath of life. In the Old Testament, it's the nephesh. The Hebrew says the nephesh. The Greek word of the Newer Testament that answers to that is the psuche. The psuche. We get a word psychology from the psuche. What it is? What is it? It's the study of animals that have the breath of life. The study of man as an animal. Well, what's wrong with that? Why didn't it work? And it doesn't work. Statistics don't mean anything. You see, what they're trying to predict, as all legislation is, it's an attempt to predict human behavior in the future. All legislation is an attempt to preempt future human behavior, to control the future. What's psychobabbleology, psychoology? What's that about? It's about compiling evidence and statistics whereby men can control or think they're going to be able to control the future behaviors of men. Well, that's silliness too, utter silliness. Why? Because men are more than just the animal nature, the psuche, the breath of life. There's more to a man than that. A whole lot of it. Sir Isaac Newton said it this way. Sir Isaac Newton, the fellow, remember the apple fell on his head, supposedly, and the light went on in his brain. He had that aha moment, and he said, gravity, falling objects fall in vacuums at the rate of 32 feet per second. Now, I didn't make good grades when I was in the grades, but I learned that in the eighth grade and never forgot it. Well, Sir Isaac Newton discovered that. Sir Isaac Newton said, I can predict. He was a smart fellow. He said, I can predict with absolute precision, the movements of the heavenly bodies. I can tell you where they're going to be 1,000 years from now. I can tell you exactly where they'll be 10,000 years from now. That's true. And now, of course, we don't have to use paper and pencil to do that. Book the numbers, all we got to do is stick it in a computer program, but the numbers have already been booked by the mind of man, and the positions of stars and all the other things up in the skies, the sun, the moon, can be pinpointed with absolute precision. And Sir Isaac Newton said he could do that. He can, he could. But then he said in the same breath, I cannot in any way ever predict the future behavior of men. And nobody on the faces of God's green earth has ever been able to do that. Oh, you find patterns. But then all of a sudden, somebody blows the pattern. And they say, well, I guess that didn't work. That's what psychobabble is, but critical legal theory, critical race theory. You say, Brent, are you really qualified to make these kind of comments? Well, I remember reading the legal philosophers. I read them all the ones that were famous in our day, and all the ones that were famous in the last century. I think I've read all of the ones that were famous, well-known. I've read their books, and every one of them, every one of these legal philosophers were using logic to try to determine the best source of law. The best source of law. Law, well, yeah, that's what's right and what's wrong in any given specific instance. And they have tried to discover using legal philosophy, using logic, these legal philosophers. They'll call it all sorts of different things. Well, I'm in this camp, I'm in that camp. It all comes back to the same thing. Critical legal theory, we're going to use logic to find the truth. That's like having a screen door on a submarine. It's like about as much sense as a soup sandwich. It's just silliness. Utter silliness. Remember, Blackstone, he said, facts have to come before logic. You've got to establish the facts. We ask the jury, what's the facts? They don't do that in the rest of the world. Have we stopped to consider how important that is? Well, critical legal theory and all these legal philosophers, they've all struggled. When it comes down to it, what they're struggling to do is to find out who gets to decide. Who gets to decide right from wrong in individual instances? From whose decision there is no appeal. Who gets to do that? Oh, they come up with a lot of theories. And they're all wrong. All of them. These are great minds. They really do know how to use Aristotle and Plato's logic. Oh, they understand it very well, and they are very careful. They've taken courses on logic. They know all the false kinds of logic there are and how the philosophers have identified false logic. They know it all. What's it get them? Nothing. Why? They never have a consensus. All these smart people never get a consensus on the source of true law. Who gets to decide right and wrong in individual instances? From whose decision there is no appeal? Who is that? Our Declaration of 76 tells us point blank, in clear terms, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. Two volumes, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. Rome has said the laws of nature is logic. And Thomas Aquinas, a fellow I mentioned a while ago, Thomas Aquinas, his writings are the official doctrine of Rome. What's the official doctrine of Rome? Logic. Fact? Forget it. We're not interested. We're going to make it up as we go, the facts, and then we'll build our logic on the facts we make up. All false religion does that. It's false. Well, you say, all false religion? Yeah, so many that I couldn't name them all. I don't know them all. I don't have to know them all. I don't care who the counterfeits are. I can identify them quickly. I don't care what the label is. Why? Because I'm looking at the real article. Now, if you want to discover what a counterfeit bill looks like, you've heard this. If you want to discover what a counterfeit bill looks like, all you got to do is study the real article, a real bill. And then when you see the counterfeit, you'll recognize it instantaneously. Well, I ain't bragging, it's just a fact. I know the truth. I study it. I measure everything against the laws of nature, unwritten. In the nature of creation and the laws of nature's God, says William Blackstone, the laws of nature's God written, lex scripta, in the Bible. These two volumes and no others, these two volumes and no more. And we as Americans have a law. It's a clear law. It's a good law. We don't need to go looking for some philosopher to tell us from what the source of true law is. No, we know. All men know. They know it too. But they don't like it. Why? Because it demands things of them that makes them feel guilty. That's why. And that's the struggle we all have to varying degrees. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, CommonLawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And we're talking about critical legal theory and critical race theory. These are the theories of men and women. They want to make it up as they go. Subjectively, they don't want any external objective standard whereby to govern their relationship with somebody else. No, you have to submit to them and what their subjectivity says. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, CommonLawyer.com, and you can go there and listen to us talk from now till the cows come home. Shut us off when you're tired. Thank you, John. And Gerard, I'll bet Gerard's here. Maybe John.
Not tonight.
Not tonight. Well, anyway, John, thank you so much. Back to you.
Well, thank you, Brent. And feel free to pipe in on any of these questions and comments if you want. Okay, we're going to go back to our queue here. We only have one person in the queue, by the way. Star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Anybody who has a question or a comment, star 6 and a 1. Take our next caller, Dan. How you doing, Dan? North Carolina.
Greetings, everyone. Can you hear me very well?
We got you. No problems tonight coming in the queue, right?
Not. I got it late, believe it or not, that it operated, but it wouldn't allow me very early. But when you said those that want to come in the queue, and then the automation attendant came on and says, you may now, if you want to, you know, hit the one to to get into the queue. So it worked that part. Anyway, let's certainly just be in awe as to what we've just heard from Mr. Brent and Alan Winters. I take notes every time, and it's always tremendous insight and things that we've never heard of in a lot of times. And I'm so appreciative of what he was just giving us a expound.
Oh, okay. Forget it. No, go right ahead. Okay.
And also with that, at some point he might want to speak on the same subject with what is in inducing into reasoning by induction and by the rules of deduction at some point. And he might want to elaborate on that at some point. With that said, the main thing that I wanted to speak about last Monday night, and I was in the queue, but it just never came for somewhere that I could speak. There was a gentleman in closing with you here that was asking for the insight of about a flag on a pole. And I think he was referring to more than likely the Gold Fringe flag. And that Gold Fringe flag, someone stated that came from England. I'm not sure about this, and it could be. But from our sources, the Gold Fringe flag is our commander in
chief. The fringed flag might very well have come from other countries. The idea of the fringed flag might have come from other countries, and other countries apply it the same way, I would think. You know, Brent might know more about that because he looks into the history of the comments. So if he wants to comment on that, he can. But you may have a point there that, you know, other countries use it too, maybe. I don't know for sure, but...
If he is still on, I certainly will yield to him about this.
I'm here. I want to say something.
Yeah, go right ahead, Brent.
Is this about the flag of the United States? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what he's talking about, and where it came from, in the sense that someone had mentioned that we got it, the idea from Britain, which might be true too. You know, because flag. You know. Yeah. But go ahead. If you want to comment on it, go ahead, Brent.
Mr. Brent, the Gold Fringe, comment on the Gold Fringe flag and on a pole, if you would.
Well, I may not be hitting the nail with my head, but the flag of the United States, without question, is the flag of the British East India Company. That's fact. Man, I want to talk more about that, but if I may, John, one of the listeners asked if they could say something before I quit talking about critical legal theory. And it shouldn't take but just a second.
Go right ahead.
Is that all right?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Go ahead.
Certainly.
Terry, go ahead. Terry?
Okay, I wanted to say that this critical race theory stuff, they're doing several things. One is they change the language so that it mixes you up. You're saying one thing with words that mean objectively what they mean, just like you were saying, Brent, and yet they mean something totally different, and it just messes things up. The roots of this whole critical race theory and everything is in Marxism. They're trying to establish, in critical race theory, a difference in races of people instead of the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie, the laborers versus the elite that Marx did. And they emphasize groups over individuals. And this all came from the Frankfurt School, which was set up for Marxism from Moscow.
Good God Almighty.
We advocate for common law. CRT proponents advocate against the idea that laws could be written in a neutral way. It may be easy for them to label us I'm talking NLA here, or claim partnership against unjust law. And I don't want that to happen. We need to protect against these things. And I just wanted to ask how. Thank you.
Brent, did you want to comment on that? Did we lose Brent? Oh, no, he's still here, but he's muted. Yeah, you got to unmute, Brent.
Oh, yes, now I'm unmuted.
There you go.
Say,
yep.
How do we combat critical race theory, critical legal theory?
Yes.
You drive out darkness with light. You don't focus on critical race theory. And they want us to do. They're trying to drag us off into their field to play on their court. They're going to win if you do that. They'll win. Don't do that. Don't get caught up in logical bouts trying to show them you're more logical than they are. It doesn't make any difference. And that's what they want you to do. The devil is very wily, and he knows how to make you ineffective. And the way to become effective is to be offensive. Offensive. That means on the offense, not the defense. That means you don't talk about what they want to talk about. If I learned anything in politics, not that I always follow it, but I did learn this, I don't care what the question is, I answer and talk about what I want to talk about. You remember Ronald Reagan? Ronald Reagan was successful among many reasons. One of them was he only had two issues. That made it easy. Keep it simple, stupid. He only had two issues, and no matter what question was ever asked, and boy, he had this down to a science. You know, he ran for president for 20 years. He learned the ropes before he got there. Oh, yeah, everything he did, he was running for president for 20 years, and he learned that no matter what anybody said, he had to control the narrative, and the only way to do that is to do what you want to do. Don't let them pull you into bouting with them on their turf. The facts are the facts. I don't argue with people. I don't. Well, I have. I get pulled into it sometimes, but I try not to. Well, that's all very nice, I say. Looks great on paper. Only problem is it's a damnable lie, so I don't want to hear it. Get away from me. I got to move on. I got things to do. I don't have time to waste time with people that want to drag me into never-ending paralysis of analysis. The paralysis of analysis, that's where they are. Never get anything done. Then they want to sit around on shag rugs, smoke pot, and talk. Well, I'm not interested. I'm going to kick somebody's butt and move on. And I hope that's the way they would feel about it, but they don't. They want to distract me into getting on their turf and doing things the way they do it. So that's the remedy, is to be positive. You've got the facts. Move on. The facts are there is a set of laws that are the way things are, and they will not change. That ends it. I don't care what anybody else says or does. I don't care what your logic is. I don't even care if you're perfectly logical. The problem is you based your logic on something that wasn't true, and so no matter how impeccable and how tight your logic is, you're never going to arrive at the truth. What we're fighting over here, friends, neighbors, and kin, just like in a common law trial, we're not fighting over logic. We're not even fighting over law. We're fighting over facts. The law may be factual. It may not be. If it is not factual, we'll fight over that. But we're fighting over facts. That's what matters, just the facts, ma'am. That was a famous line because it captured our American tradition. That line of Joe Friday's, you know, when I said that, you knew what I was talking about. Well, that didn't stick for nothing. It had real meaning. It still does. Well, that's my comment about it. But I'm going to move on to the American flag, and I don't know much about the French flag. Don't really care much about what the French are doing. They try to base everything they do on impeccable logic and beautiful elegance and the beauty of the equation, but they don't care about the fact that much. Why? Well, like Merriman said over there at Bolt Hall in Berkeley, he said, when you stress, logic, facts have a way of receding from consideration because the beauty and the elegance of a wonderful argument captures the mind. And that's what the evil empire has always been about, and that's what it's about now. That's what the snake did to our grandma, Grandma Eve. He just talked about things that are logical and sensible. Go ahead, put the gun to your head. It's not loaded, Eve. Put the gun to your head. It's not loaded. Pull the trigger. That's what he said, in essence, by principle. And that's what they're saying with all the what they're saying. Don't get caught up making arguments. And so I hear people say, oh, that's the craziest thing I ever heard. That's senseless. That's not logical. Well, of course, get over it. Move on. Get away from those people. Let the dead bury the dead. We got things to do. Well, anyway, that's my point of view about that. But back to the flag of the United States. I had a hard time getting off of that scholasticism baloney. Back to the flag of the United States. So no question, you go to the internet and see all the different forms of the flags of the British East India Company going back a few hundred years. And they're all a little different over the centuries. They change, but the fundamental stars and stripes in red, white, and blue doesn't change. I've read books where men, British men, and English and Americans both have delved into why that is true and why the Americans took up the fundamental design of the flag of the British East India Company. I have never found anybody yet, and if you find anybody, please come and tell me, email me, tell me I found a book that has found the reason why. I haven't found it. But if you do, let me know. That's all I know about it, John. Do you know anything about it?
Well, what I'd like to say, you know, what a lot of people are talking about is this fringed flag. And, you know, I referred back to USC 04, you know, US Code 4, which does give information on the flag. But I haven't found any information in there concerning a fringed flag, you know, with the orange or the yellow fringes. I'm not sure whether it's yellow or orange. I think it's yellow. And you'll see that when the president talks, you'll see those fringe flags. You see them in quite a few places, usually around the military. And, you know, a lot of the federal courts will have the fringe flags. And, you know, and I presumed, and you know what happens when you presume things. I had presumed that, well, okay, there must be a reason for that, and we would find it in USC 4. And I've always heard that it identifies with ultimately at sea, you know, particularly the military. But I tell you what, I'm not finding it anywhere in government. I'm clearly, you know, it's referred to, the flag is referred to USC 4, and USC 4 does not mention anything with a flag with fringes on it. And it gives the design of the flag, the size of the flag, and a lot of details on the flags and you know, how much space the stars take up, and then the length of the, depending on the length of the flag, and then the stripes, you know. But nothing on fringes. So I don't know, have you heard anything about the fringes, or what do you think about that?
The fringes, you say? Yeah. The fringes on the American flag?
The fringes on the flag.
Yes, and people complain, of course.
Yeah.
Which has been complaining for decades, well, that's the Admiralty flag of Admiralty jurisdiction, and they are absolutely correct.
Yeah,
it's the flag of Admiralty jurisdiction.
But there's nothing on the U.S. codes on it that I've found.
No, a lot of customs we have in our common law, of course, but the federal courts have Admiralty jurisdiction, so there's nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah,
the Constitution of the United States.
I thought, yeah, if it's identifying with Admiralty,
yeah,
absolutely they have jurisdiction in that. There's nothing wrong with that flag flying. But what I'm trying to say, and I just discovered this today because I was looking for this while we were all talking, in USC 4, it doesn't give any description for that. They're very specific on the flag here. You know, when you go into USC 4, for instance, let me just go back a few pages. It says here, yeah, it gives a pledge of allegiance to the flag. It talks about hoisting the flag, how it flies, what the length is, and, you know, a lot of information. But it also describes the flag and how it's designed. The design of the flag, Section 1, the flag of the United States shall have 13 horizontal stripes, alternate red and white, and a union consisting of white stars on the field of blue. Section 2, the positions of the stars in the union of the flag and in the Union Jack shall be as indicated on the attachment of this order, which is hereby made as part of this order. Section 3, the dimensions and consistent, constituent flag, I'm not sure what that word, anyway, of the flag shall conform to proportions set forth in the attachment referred to in Section 2 of this order. And then it talks about, you know, for instance, the size of the flag, 20 feet and 38 feet, fly length and hoist width. And it gets into all those details. But the description of the flag, the colors of the flag, everything is in here. But it doesn't give anything concerning a flag with fringes. And I'm wondering where we would find that information.
Oh, yeah.
What is the detail of that particular flag, you know?
You make a point, and that's something I'll keep my eyes cocked for. One of the things about the American flag is we have a misconception of what it was to start with. The American flag is a battle flag. The American flag wasn't important to Americans that much in the earlier days after our country started, except that it was a battle flag. That's important. But most people, and this is, I only know what I read the history of the matter, most people had never seen the American flag. Most people for the first 85 years of our history had never seen an American flag because they didn't live near any military bases, and it was only flown in military formation, military bases, military ships, and merchant ships that, of course, fly under the protection of the flag of the United States. Most Americans didn't. A lot of them had, of course, migrated into the Midwest. They didn't know anything about the American flag. And the American flag never became famous to Americans until it was hauled down under the bombardment at Fort Sumter. That was the first time the American flag had ever been hauled down after our country had started. And because that was the first time it had ever been hauled down, it ticked people off. And then they said, well, that's our flag. And then some people, of course, started using the flag more. And the flag then became visible to Americans. They understood what it was. They heard what happened at Fort Sumter. And the flag became famous, and it's been famous ever since. Oh, it was known by many, but not widely known and not widely flown like it is today. It is a battle flag. All flags traditionally have been battle flags from the history of mankind forward. You can even go to the Bible and see they call them banners. The translation says banners. Those are flags of the militia of the 12 tribes of Israel. The several militia of the 12 tribes of Israel each had a separate battle flag. And even the flag of the United States and our military units always carry their own, or used to. I don't know if they still do. Things are so weird now, but since they've made our military forces experimentations of social experimentation, instead of wanting them to be there to win battles, they've shifted their emphasis. And that is a tragedy, of course. But the flag is something that, it is not to us what it was to Americans during the first 184 years ago. And there was no reason for that either. That was, I mean, I'm talking about the whole thing with Sumter. That was a ridiculous boondoggle on both sides, like most things government does. Well, that's all I know about the flag, probably in a nutshell.
Well, here's something else that I found here. Here's something else I found here, and I'll just read this. Records of the Department of the Army indicate that fringe was used on a national flag as early as 1835. Wow. And its official use by the Army dates 1895. There is no record of an act of Congress, and that's what I'm trying to say, that I'm discovering, I'm not seeing any record. There is no record of an act of Congress or executive order which either prescribes or forbids, I mean, forget the forbidding, which prescribes the addition of fringe, nor is there any indication that any symbolism was ever associated with it. The use of fringe is optional with the person or organization displaying the flag. Now, I absolutely disagree with that conclusion. It's not optional. It's either the American flag or it's not. And if there is an American flag prescribed by Congress for a certain purpose, like admiralty or military, then it should be saying so. And if it doesn't say so, then they shouldn't be flying that flag. And that's my opinion at this point. I don't find nothing in here for a fringe flag. And that now has become disturbing, because up until today, I acknowledge that, because everyone else was saying it. And again, I made an assumption, and you know what happens when you make an assumption. You better go check things out before you do that, because you can make the facts instead of the assumption. So
you go into a Yeah. You go in, well, me too, about that. You go into a federal courtroom, there are symbols, there are Roman symbols all over.
Maybe the Supreme just thought of that.
Yeah, well, yeah, and Congress didn't okay any of that. And there's all sorts of pagan symbols on our national buildings and idols of all sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And that Congress didn't okay all that either. So we've got a lot of problems, and that's why people, too, a lot of people say the flag of the United States is an idol. Well, I don't go as far as say that, and there's reasons why an idol is something to which you attribute magical or supernatural powers, and I don't see that.
Well, our flag represents the Republic, period.
Yeah, I'm not doing that, but I think some people maybe do, I don't know.
Mm.
But a lot of our symbols, and the flag is a good example of this, it just came on, and by common use we accept it, but Congress has never, as you just pointed out, said much about it. I hadn't looked into that, but I've heard that, and now you're telling me you found that to be true.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So, you know, now I got to step back on my thinking on the French flag. It does not belong in a court of law, certainly. And it doesn't belong in a court of equity either, because it is not as acknowledged in any way by a legislator for any purpose. And if there's a French flag, it has to have a purpose. And if it has a purpose, it has to be defined. And it's not defined, so it's secret. It gets back to priestly things, very same things that Jefferson complained about, you know, with all these priestly laws and ideas and so on. You know, it's secret. You know, they don't want the people to know, but they have to obey it, you know. So, yeah, there's a problem here, and I'm not sure what it is. I'm gonna dig deeper in this one.
So. Mr. John?
Yeah.
If I may, when you see the Speaker of the House and he is saying, "All rise, I give you the President of the United States," and you see the Star Spangled Banner, the Betsy Ross flag, which is We the People's flag, it's hung on the wall, and we've been taught that that's the peace flag. When you see a flag that is on a pole being flown, especially the gold French flag, we are told that that is the Admiralty court venue.
But we're not seeing that in law.
Pardon?
We're not seeing that in equity. We don't find it anywhere in equity.
When you go into these small courts, it's 3,300 and I believe 14 counties, I'll promise you they will have, like, in North Carolina, they'll have the North Carolina flag.
I agree with you. I see them in every courtroom. I see them everywhere. And even the towns and villages, I see them everywhere. But what I'm trying to say is, what is it that it represents? If it's
going
to be in our courtroom. Okay, go ahead.
Here's what we're being told of many seminars, and I might be wrong, but I want to run this by Mr. Brent.
But being told that it has anything to do with admiralty, has anything to do with military, well, that's a lie from hell if Congress has not applied that as being the facts of its representation. Look, when it describes the flag in USC 4, it talks about 13 stripes, and of course we know what that represents. It represents the 13 original colonies.
If you allow me for just a second, this has really been need to be said a long time ago, and you guys are on target here to some good quality input already. What I'm trying to tell you is that, just for example, in North Carolina, when you go in and where the DA is and the judge is up on that bench and a black dress, and you're seeing two flags. You're seeing one, the North Carolina flag, and you might see the Betsy Ross Star Spangled Banner on a pole, but you are absolutely going to see the gold fringe flag, which is the Admiralty flag, denoting a court of admiralty. And also it represents the military, the commander-in-chief. There is nothing wrong with our commander-in-chief if you walked in a court, a military court, for them to fly the Admiralty flag, but it's a problem when in 314 counties that your sheriff comes out and they bring paperwork called a NOM, N-O-M, space, day, D-E, space, GERR, G-U-E-R-R-E. If anybody will look that up, you'll find out that is a scheme of a warlike name that the DA is sending out by the sheriff, which is a third illegal twin, so to speak, of who that party is, and they bring that party into that courtroom, and technically you're talking about a violation of the Nuremberg trials, because that person very likely is not military, has no one-on-one relationship with violating anything that where the military would be subjecting them to a military trial. However, they use this scheme, and I'm going to close right here and turn it back to you guys. They use that scheme under color of law. The DA knows every bit of this in every over 3,314 counties, these courts. And it's a scheme under what we call color of law, which is not common law, which is completely brought about by corrupt attorneys. And our framers told us and warned us, if the attorneys, now Brent, I hope you're not going to be offended by this, because Brent's not one of these anyway, get involved in making the laws, then our sons and daughters, and it goes right on our son, this is what the framers told us, and right on, will be ever forever in bondage. So the scheme of nom de guerre, and also another part is a misnomer. They use a spelling of who you are that is not on your birth certificate. It's all a scheme. And when you go up there, you are subjected with guns and with a sheriff and all this stuff here inside that courtroom, especially when you go through them little doors around that DA's, where that DA is. So I hope people understand when you're talking about the gold fringe flag, in closing, that is flown on a pole. It represents troops on a move. I'm not against, my father spent 26 years in the Coast Guard and fought the wars and everything else, Guadalcanal and all this. I'm not in no way against the military having their distinction of the gold French flag. However, the law should be out in the sea if it's admiralty, and that we should have common law in these 3,314 little courts I'm referring to, and not under, and common law would have nothing to do with a scheme. And in a scheme, I'll close with this. Mr. Brent, you correct me. You cannot have a contradiction in any kind of lawsuit or any kind of contract that's supposed to be of legitimacy, of be legal. And so those courts are operating with a conflict immediately, where the people are not aware of the disguise that the DA is proceeding under, and when they go through that little door, buddy, they've had it. It's slaughter, most cases. It's not common law, and if you even ask for a trial by jury, which you have that right, anything over $20, Seventh Amendment, or the Sixth Amendment for that matter, on criminal issues, or Seventh Amendment for civil, anything over $20, you have the right to trial by jury. They will deny you that with a blink of their eyes, and you have trouble with them from there on.
All right, well, again, I don't have a conclusion on that, and the representation of the flag is what people say it is, but I'm not finding any documentation to secure any meaning for it. But what I have found is that USC 4, which describes the flag, the American flag, that represents this great republic, is clearly defined to the colors, the size, everything. Every definition of that flag is laid out, and the proportions of that flag, as you maybe have a 20-foot flag versus a 3-foot or a 4-foot flag. But nowhere are you finding anything with fringe anywhere in our legislation. So there's no authority to put fringes on a flag. And why would you put fringe on the flag? Because it looks nice. Well, one of the things I did see here is that Britain, going all the way back quite some time and before the Revolution, they've had fringes on their flag, okay? And they're not sure what that means. Maybe surrounded by civil law or something, because we know Britain was taken over by civil law just like we have. But, we have an opportunity to save that if the people start to step up. And the other flag I found that identifies with America in one way or another, but not really, just in a fraudulent way, is the flag in Washington, D.C. that represents the District of Columbia, which has three red stars, each symbolizing city-states, which we know, of course, brings us back to the Organic Act of 1871. But this flag identifies with three cities. We have religious power, we have economic power, and we have military power. And so one's Washington, D.C., the star, another one is London, another one is Vatican City. And that flag has fringes. It's got two red stripes, three red stars, and yellow fringe around it. And the representation again is really given to the idea of the fraud of the U.S. Incorporation. But I've assumed, and again, that's what got me in trouble. I confess and I apologize, but I presumed that somewhere in, because I didn't go to read it until just this evening, that somewhere in USC 4 is the description of a admiralty flag and or a military flag identified by fringes. It's not true. Look at, when a ship goes out to sea, that flag that's flying represents what? It represents we, the people. It represents the nation, the power and the authority, particularly of a military ship, or even economically, with any other kind of ship that's flying an American flag. But I see no authority for any courtroom to be put in American. Why do they have that flag up there is my question now. Because I didn't see a problem with it before, because I presumed it identified, again, that word presumed, I presumed it identified with admiralty, or shall I say equity, and that it was appropriate because, look at, there's supposed to be two sides of that court of equity and court of law. And of course, law has been shut down, and it's just equity, and equity has been changed. Actually, it's not even equity. They fused equity and law and call it civil law, and that happened by the Rules Enabling Act of 1934. Which really didn't give them the authority to do that. That being the Bar Association controlled the writing of the rules of the court in 1938, approved by the United States Supreme Court. They all should be hung for treason. But nevertheless, they came to that point in time. Where they fused the laws and call it civil law. That was a takeover of our courts. And now we see every court in this nation, because I see it in villages, I see it in towns, I see it in counties, I see it in states, and I see it in the federal courts. Every court in America seems to have that. Why? What does it mean? What's the purpose? Why? We don't have an answer. I don't have an answer yet. We need to see more what we can find out about this, but I don't think we're going to get a clear answer because they hide. It's all secret stuff, It's a secret game they play. That's where we're at, I think, my opinion. It don't belong in any court because it's not approved by our legislators as to, and if it was approved, it would tell what it identifies, what the purpose of that flag is for, and what it represents. Just like it does right here in USC 14 for the American flag. So I have no idea what it's for. Anyway, we have some other people in the queue, Dan. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, and we're going to move to the next caller. Thanks, Dan.
Absolutely. You too, and Mr. Brent.
Okay, let us go to Heather Lee. Go right ahead, Heather. You got the mic.
Yes. My question this evening is about the oath of office. And I'd like Brent to elaborate on the oath of office that these county officials, if you want to call them county positions, take, and also the judicial system, the Admiralty judicial system of judges and bar attorneys, that they take an oath of office, and which is breached by administering Admiralty Roman law. And I would like you to elaborate on that oath of office and how one would hold their feet to the fire.
Oaths? I'm being heard. Oaths,
yep.
Are not. Oaths, an oath is probably one of the weakest attempts of surety of truth that we have in our tradition. The oath is a very poor surety of truth. I mean, anybody that's lived knows that oaths are made to be broken. Just like we say promises are made to be broken. A promise is not worth the paper it's written on. It's men are by nature promise breakers. The oath is in support of a promise. The oath is not the promise. The oath is in support of the promise. An oath is where a fellow calls God in to witness his promise. Mm-hmm. He calls God in to witness his promise, and he says, I promise that if I do not keep my promise, that I turn myself over to this God who will take his vengeance out on me. And that's what an oath is. You know, only the God of all creation is the only one anybody ever called a God who says that I will require your oath of you. I will require the promise that you make under oath of you. Is that true? Of course it's true. No other religious point of view says that, of no other supposed God. Our God alone is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the Bible, the lawgiver, the creator of all things. He says that he will not allow anybody to get by with ignoring their oath. But again, what is an oath? It is just a calling in of a greater, namely the God of all creation, a calling in of the God of all creation to witness your promise. And by doing so, you say to the other fella you're making the promise to, if I don't fulfill my promise, I turn myself over to the God of all vengeance. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff. And the Bible says don't do that lightly. Jesus Christ said, do not do it olas. That means generally. Do not do it flippantly. Matter of fact, you ought to be careful not to do it at all. Don't have to worry about it. But the truth is, we find people in the Bible make oaths constantly. Paul the Apostle made oaths constantly in his epistles, even to the Corinthians. He calls God in to witness what he's saying to be true. Calls God himself in to witness. May God forbid is one of the phrases used. That's not precisely an oath, but that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Well, an oath, I said, is not a great surety of truth. If an oath is not the great surety of truth, what is in our common law tradition? I'll tell you what it is. The greatest surety of truth in our common law tradition is something we do in our common law tradition, again, that nobody else in the whole world does. Not in any place except in common law countries. What is it? Cross-examination. We do cross-examination, the greatest surety of truth in our common law tradition. When I say surety, yes, I mean cross-examination is what we depend upon to draw out the truth. No, we don't do like the rest of the world. The rest of the world, they torture people. They tie you to a post, give you 40 lashes, hold you down on the ground and beat you half to death. Oh, nothing personally, I understand. We just we're entitled to know what you know, and if you ain't going to tell us, we're going to beat it out of you. Or we'll throw you in jail and leave you for a couple years without enough food and water to really feed you, or we'll throw you in a dungeon like they did to William Tyndale and those fellows, throw you in a dungeon where it's nothing but mud up to your ankles for the next 6 to 8 months. If you live through it, great. But in the meantime, maybe you'll see this. Maybe you'll see it our way. And we'll make you an offer you can't refuse. We'll take you out of jail if you just agree to talk to us in a dungeon someplace. Well, that's not assurative truth, even beating people or torturing them to death or putting them on the rack like they do in the rest of the world. South America is famous for such things. They like to use electrodes, attach electrodes to your private body parts. But here's the other thing that must be said about an oath. Talk to prosecutors. I've talked to U.S. attorneys. And I've talked to them about the oath. In tax cases, you know, when you sign a tax return, a 1040, 1120, whatever it is, you're swearing that what you've said on the return is true. That's an oath. You say, well, I didn't call in God. Well, that's not the way God looks at it. If you sign under penalties of perjury, and that's all it says, well, God's not going to take that lightly either. But I'm not telling you anything about tax returns. I'm making this point, and I want you to watch this very closely. Listen to what I'm saying. Lying under perjury is not lying under oath. Perjury is not lying under oath. Well, of course it is, Brent. Every lawyer I've ever talked to, I've heard them say it. I've heard judges say it. Yeah, I have too. They don't know what they're talking about. Perjury is not lying under oath. How do I know? Because it never has been in the history of Christianity. It isn't in the Bible. That's not what it is. And by the way, the Supreme Court of the United States has said that lying under oath is not perjury. A 1925 case, one of the first cases that the Supreme Court considered concerning tax returns. And the Supreme Court of the United States said perjury. You can read the case. I can't remember the name of it, but isn't it funny? We were talking about flags a while ago on gold fringe. People say, well, why do they got the gold fringe on the flag? Well, things just become habit. They put the fringe on there, like John said a while ago, because it's pretty. Really, I believe that's the only reason it was ever done. Now they say it's an admiralty flag, and nobody knows why we do this or why we do that. Here it is. There, we're doing it. That's like saying...
I think that means they're hiding something.
Yeah, it makes you think. The perjury... That's true. But to say lying under oath is perjury is just a habit that started, and everybody believes it. And it's not true, not even a little bit. Now, the Bible is very distinct about the difference between perjury and just telling a lie. Now, a lie under oath, lying under oath. Here's what perjury is. If perjury is not lying under oath, what is it? Oh, I searched for years to try to explain this in a way that would be quickly grabbable, or grab you and you'd understand it. But it's not that people are stupid. No, people aren't stupid. It's just that when you get your mind so accustomed to a certain thing, perjury is lying under oath. That's what everybody's accustomed to. It's a complete shift of a paradigm to say it's something else, and it's hard to grasp for that reason, not because anybody's stupid. That's not it. Now try to grasp the simplicity of this. Well, then what is perjury? Perjury is taking an oath, and while you're taking that oath, at the very moment you're taking that oath, you are lying. If I get on the witness stand and say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God, and that statement is a lie, and I know it's a lie, and I don't intend to tell the truth, that's perjury. Here's the way the Supreme Court put it. The Supreme Court said, perjury is complete. The crime of perjury is complete upon the taking of the oath. And it is prosecutable. You don't have to lie under oath to be prosecuted for perjury. Well, if you do lie under oath, that'd be a weak evidence that you committed perjury. But shucks, people get on the witness stand and say all sorts of things that aren't true. They forget, their memory's foggy, they misspeak. I've often said, I hear myself recorded quite a bit, and I'll hear myself say something the exact opposite of what I thought I said. Witnesses on the witness stand are scared, they're confused, they're under cross-examination, they get all bollocked up, the words start tumbling over their teeth, and they get confused and fouled, and that's why we don't prosecute people for perjury, hardly ever. And any U.S. attorney or any prosecutor who is in the business of doing those kind of things will tell you it is almost impossible to ever convict anybody of perjury. And you won't hardly find any cases on the books. I was involved in one case one time where I knew that it was possible, maybe, to convict somebody of perjury. You have to have evidence, see, that the oath that they took, the oath itself, that when they said those words, they were lying. That's perjury. I was in a case where a fellow...
So would you say, are you saying that the intent has to be before the oath, that the intent is going to lie, not where you're taking the oath, you have no intent to lie, but then in the process of questioning or whatever, then you end up not necessarily telling the truth? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I'm saying that. Good. I'm glad you said that again. It gives me a chance to make another crack at trying to explain this. The intent to lie. No. If the lying under oath has nothing to do with it. Forget whatever you testify under oath. It's just the oath itself is a lie. When you say, "I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth," and you know in your heart you're lying through your teeth, that's perjury.
Okay.
As the Bible puts it, the translations put it, a false oath. It's the oath that is false, you see. Not the testimony you give under oath. That's the what I'm driving at.
You know, there's a case.
Can I have a question for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
On that, if a county office, okay, takes that oath to the Constitution, or a judge takes that oath to the Constitution upon entering that office, then they proceed in full well knowing, proceed in admiralty or against the Constitution of the United States, full well knowing, when they took that oath of office for that office. That's perjury.
No, that's not perjury.
How about the judge?
You could take the oath and say, I support the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and all of a sudden, the blackness of evil overcomes your heart 2 years later, and you disobey that oath. You violate that oath. That's not perjury. Let me say it again. The crime of perjury is complete.
But that could be treason.
It could be treason, right. That's true, but it's not perjury. The crime of perjury is complete and prosecutable as soon as you take the oath. Lying isn't part of the crime of perjury. Lying after you take the oath. It is the oath itself that is the lie. Well, I think I've said...
But maybe if you could prove that the person had intent of lying while taking the oath, maybe that could be a case.
That's right. Now, I was in one case that started to say a while ago where the Supreme Court of the state where this fellow lived, he was a lawyer, and they were trying to take his license. Fascinating case. And I knew him. He's a friend of mine. He's gone now. He's passed away. He was older than me by about 20 years. But they were trying to take his license for no good reason. And they had a couple of floozies there that were meth addicts to testify against him that he was a bad character because he had tried to help some of them and they were in court, etc., trying to help defend him. Anyway, I knew the lady that was in the girls' room with these two witnesses before they came on, and she heard them say that they were going to lie when they got on the witness stand. So it was obvious they were setting themselves up to lie in their testimony. Well, if that's true, then if they were going to lie, then there was intent to lie when they took the oath. If that intent lasted from the girls' room to the witness stand 30 minutes later, and as soon as they take that oath, as soon as they took that oath with intent to give false testimony, the crime of perjury is complete. Now you say, well, that just sounds like a lot of legal gobbledygook. Well, you can say that, but the Bible makes that distinction. And I think if God makes that distinction, we should make it too. Matter of fact, it's the very definition of holiness to distinguish things that he distinguishes and see the difference between things. Lying under oath is not perjury. Well, think about it. It's simple, and you're smart, and you'll see what I'm saying if you just relax and, oh, I get what Brent's saying now. But this is ancient, and the Supreme Court of the United States has said the same thing. I believe the year was 1925. Back to you, John.
Well, you know, going to intent, something recently came up in the courts, you know, when a prosecutor is going to prosecute this woman because a child died in a car, okay? I just heard this recently, maybe a week ago, on the thing that, and they're going to prosecute this woman because a child died in the car because she forgot that the child was in the car. Now, that removes intent. I mean, correct my thinking if I'm wrong here, but that removes intent, and without intent, there is no crime. I mean, if you really think about this, though, really think, you know, there's other things you can go after that person for, but if you really think about this, I mean, what greater penalty upon a parent for something like that would to happen?
No,
you forgot something, and the child died. I mean, I don't know that you can place
it. The law would call that intent because the level of
well, it's neglect. It's gross
neglect. Neglect was so great, yeah.
Let's step back. What about temporary insanity? Then the law would have to ignore that too. Then
the first case of temporary insanity that became famous was Huey Newton, the founder of the Black Panthers, and he was on the streets of
and that was
Oakland,
the first
California.
One? Really?
Yeah, that established that doctrine. Oh, the people tried it before, but it never worked. But Huey Newton, remember, he was a young fella in Oakland, California. He was a black man, the founder of the Black Panthers. He carried a law book in one hand and a pistol in the other. And when he saw a cop abusing somebody in downtown Oakland, he'd tell him to stop, and he would confront them physically. A cop shot him, gut shot him right in the gut. He fell down, and before anybody knew what had happened, he had shot the police officer and killed him. And he argued that he didn't have any intent to pull the trigger, that he was temporarily deranged from being blasted with a high-caliber pistol in the gut. And the jury went with him. That's why I remember the case. That's been a long time ago. I wasn't but a young fellow then.
Well, maybe there were enough facts within the case to for the jury to really fall upon that, and they have to be absolute in order for them to feel that the person was guilty, you know.
Yep.
But the thing you're getting it in, that intent is the key. You know, look, you're driving down the road, and, you know, maybe your mind gets taken away for a second. You look back and you hit the brakes and you kill somebody because, this is life. This is the mind. It happens, okay? There was no intent there, okay? You know, you go into a store and you leave your child in the car and you expect to be out there in minutes, and you get lost a little bit and you get back out there and, you know, I hear that children are more susceptible to the dangers in a closed car with a lot of heat, five times greater than an adult, and that may be true, I guess. But the thing is, again, there's no intent. You got to look at the facts of the case, of course, and then that would discover whether there was an intent. But I know I just don't see it. I could not, if I sat on a jury, I couldn't find myself really putting much upon an individual who lost a child because, you know, for some stupid reason, but there was no intent.
That's right. That's why we have juries, so they can do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, we were just looking at Lysander Spooner's Section 1, very, very powerful, which is only about 3-4 pages, and it lays into that kind of thing with a jury. You know, it's a representation by the country in opposed to representation by the government, and I know you know about this because I've seen this in your book, its ideas also. And so the representation is really of the whole country. I mean, and it's a collection of people you know, that represent that whole country. And yeah, that battle comes out. If one person digs their foot in, they're not going to get a conviction. And they're going to have to come to a conclusion that not guilty. Yeah, go ahead.
I just need to reiterate on this, and maybe I need to be clearer on it. When a judge that is under admiralty, not under constitutional law, and proceeds in oath, or proceeds in Roman law, okay, with intent, knowing full well, or a someone in the bar, full well knowing that they're under admiralty, and admiralty is not common law, and they take that oath of office to the Constitution and do not hold up the Constitution, fully intending not to do so, and not allowing anyone to quote the Constitution in their courtroom because they're under admiralty law jurisdiction. Jurisdiction unknown to the Constitution, to common law. Do they not break it with the intent if they take an oath to the Constitution?
Well, look at the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court calls that, goodness, what's the word I'm looking for here? That calls that, wow, just fell out of my brain here. It is not subversion, but
treason.
Calls that treason. They literally call that treason. They don't call it perjury. They call it treason. And I think that's the difference because, again, you're going to have to go prove that at the time, from Brent's perspective, what he's bringing up is you'd have to prove at the time they took the oath they had the intent to do that. And if you could prove that, then you can have perjury too, I guess. But treason is the key part of that whole thing.
Yeah, and I can see the treason. I can see
But they're taking you into jurisdictions unknown. They're actually, you know, hijacking you into a jurisdiction unknown. I'm in federal court right now, and they've hijacked me to jurisdictions unknown. I've demanded three times on the record, tell me what jurisdiction I'm in. And the judge outright says, no, literally no, I'm not going to tell you. And I say to the judge, well, look at how can it be that here I am in a court, and how can I represent myself, and how can I make a battle if I don't know the jurisdiction? Because if I don't know the jurisdiction, then how do I make the battle? I have to understand the jurisdiction first. And at the last time I spoke with the judge, as they were closing down the case, I said, one more time, are you going to tell me what jurisdiction we're in? And she said, no. The mic went off. Case was closed. You know, I'm waiting for a decision 3 months later, and I know she's dragging her rear end because she's guilty of treason. And she's guilty of conspiracy, working with the U.S. attorney. They've all lied in order to get into the court and stay in the court because they've all defaulted. We've had 12 defaults in this one court case.
And it's an oath to the Constitution. It's ludicrous.
It's treason. They're guilty. They've hijacked me. They're treason against me, the king.
But, why...
Little king, little king.
They take an oath to the Constitution when they full well know when they enter in that they're not going to adhere to the Constitution.
Well, again, you'd have to prove that for it to be, a perjury. I agree with, I understand what Brent is saying, and I can see the legal argument here, so I kind of agree with him. It's hard to prove it. And I've always heard it's really hard to prove perjury. I've always heard that, but I've never really thought it out, and Brent makes a good case on it.
Yeah, John, are you there?
I'm here.
Somebody messaged me and said you referred to yourself as King John and said...
But I said Little King.
What is it? I know, but somebody said, do you remember what happened to the last King John?
Yeah, I know.
A whole big history lesson in on
that. He almost had his head handed to him, I hear. Huh?
A lot of other things, but if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have Magna Carta, see?
Mm-hmm. But so, we're all kings, but we're limited to our own environment and our own home and castle, you know, and what we control in our life. So we are all kings. I mean, but it is true, there's really, and you made this point, there's only one true king, and we know that's the creator of the universe.
Yeah.
period.
Well, I appreciate Heather Lee bringing that subject up because I like to talk about it.
But I do want to say one other thing. Christ talks about being King of Kings.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, yeah.
We are the other kings. We're the little, tiny little ones, you know. But go ahead.
No, I just glad that the subject came up because I know I've got other friends in her neck of the woods. When I say her neck of the woods, I mean up there around the lakes that are even in, well, in north of Detroit that are talking to me about how do we get to these county commissioners that are violating their oath. And you know how it is. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, of course you do. People take that oath. They don't give a thought what they're doing. If you ask them to define what an oath was, they couldn't tell you. They don't even know what an oath is. Oh, I got to do that. It's just something we all accept. We never think about. Can anybody really define what an oath is? Yes. But can the most people? No. What about a vow? What's the difference between an oath and a vow? Is there a difference? Well, the Bible makes a clear distinction. It's pretty simple. But do people know? No, they don't know. They don't care. That's like saying, what's in the Constitution? They don't care. What's in the Bible? I don't care about that either, but they'll pound the books and pound the table and talk about how important it all is, but they've never read it. If they have, they won't go back and read it again and contemplate what it's saying.
Well, the best thing that could be done, though, is what California did to the governor out there. Recall him.
Yeah.
We the people have the power and the authority to recall anyone. But the thing is, in order to do that, we have to become educated, we have to become involved, we have to come together and start to see these things and act in numbers. And again, that's why we're creating committees of safety. And if people refuse to do that, you can't have self-government. Self-government is by the people involved, but you have to come up. People have to be trained in school, and we have to train ourselves and our children and make sure our schools are teaching these things that these children should know as a citizen of the United States. And I know a lot of people shrieked when I said that, but we are citizens of the United States. The word citizen is used, I think, 7 or 8 times in the Constitution. So it's nothing really bad except for they attach bad things to it. But that's just a play with the game of words. You know, they use words, we use the same words, and they attach a different meaning to us, and then they try to convict us or get around things with those meanings, those strange meanings. One more thing before we leave. I don't know if you got a final word on that, but one more thing. We do have one other person in the queue. Actually, a second person just came in, but we're going to take one other person because they've been a while. We're all a little over time. Anything final on that, Brent, or are we done?
Oh, no, I'm done. I've said plenty.
Okay. All right, Heather Lee.
I'll save mine for a little bit later, maybe.
Yeah, talk again next week. I don't want to get
to get
Catherine in. She's been in for a while there, and she's been sitting there.
Yeah, it was something that Robert was working on with me, and one of the things. And so mm-hmm. I just wanted to go a little further. I'll elaborate.
Yeah, well, yeah, expound on them maybe next week or another time because I'm interested in hearing
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fred.
Okay, we're going to take Catherine. Go right ahead, Catherine. You got the mic. We only got a couple, but we're over time, so we want to
hang on. Oh, gosh. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I can barely hear you, so I'm going to... If you need to interrupt me at all, yell really loud because I can barely hear you. Okay. So I have a few comments. One was on the flag with the gold fringe. Here's the deal. If you look it up, if you just go do a general internet search, I'm not going to tell you which platform to use, but do a search on gold fringe flag, it's going to come up as a ceremonial flag. And I can guarantee you that the judges do not do the ordering of the flags. The system doesn't do the ordering of the flags. So it's either going to be the clerk or it's going to be staff that does the ordering of the flags. They have no idea what a gold fringe flag means. It's a ceremonial flag. It looks important. It looks special. It looks, parade-like. It looks official, et cetera, et cetera. It has no more meaning than that. I can tell you that in the county where I live, the court does not have gold fringe flags. They are just regular flags, just like you hang out on your balcony. And it has no more meaning to anybody than a gold fringed flag, because really nobody knows what you're talking about. So anybody who goes into a court, and I can tell you that the courts with no fringe on their flags and the fringe that are no less lawless than the courts with the gold fringe flags. So if you go into a court and you start talking about gold fringe flags, the judge is going to think of you that you're just as much of an idiot as everybody else who's in the courtroom who has no idea what you're talking about, because the judge does not know either.
And oh, I agree.
Nobody in the court. The court, there is no court until you're in it. And when you're in it, the court, the people that are in that court, the people that are seated and oath sworn into that service, they have no idea what anybody's talking about with the gold fringe flag. Okay, so the other was on perjury. Perjury being, I loved Brent's explanation of that, because it really is a personal matter. It is literally between you and God. It's the person and God. So if you intend to lie and it can be proven, then it could be proven as a crime of perjury, but you'd have to be able to prove the intent. So that was all I wanted to really say about that. And then the other thing is, there is no judge under constitutional law. That does not exist. The Constitution does not exist in any level of government, including the judiciary in this country, period. So you're not going to go into a room and find that a judge, whether they're oath sworn the flag doesn't matter, and really nothing matters. It doesn't matter what level of judiciary either. There is no court or any level of government that is under the Constitution. The Constitution simply does not apply. That no longer applies, and people need to accept that. You know, the arguments about, you know, admiralty or this, that, or the other thing, it is anything. It literally is whatever the system says it is. And at this point, it is whatever the judge in that courtroom says it is. So, for example, anybody, I'm going to tell you right now, go to YouTube and type in raw video, Michigan judge threatens restaurant owner with contempt of court. And watch that 4-minute and 14-second video, and that will tell you, that will give you an idea of what an activist judge is, and that there is literally no foundation of law constraining any level of government. So, splitting hairs on this, that, or the other thing, you know, jurisdiction and blah, 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 blah. None of that stuff even matters anymore. That doesn't even apply.
You're not saying that we need to submit, though.
No, right? That's not what I'm saying at all. No, okay. That's not what I'm saying at all. No, I'm saying if you find yourself going into court, you had better get yourself educated.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, going into court is very dangerous, or it can become very dangerous, and I agree with you on that. The flag in the court, I believe the flag does belong in the court, and it should be the flag that's identified under USC 4, and I do believe it belongs in every court of this nation, because that represents a natural law republic.
Republic
for which it stands, you know?
Right.
And
that's
so it's a representation of that, and it should be acknowledged of that. The problem is that they don't give it the acknowledgement. They're all criminals. They all belong in jail.
So the thing is, restore your republic,
that's what we
and then
do.
That gets fixed.
That's
but
it.
until you've gone through the process of restoring the republic, and specifically in your county, and then, you know,
that's something that grows across the country.
So the other thing was oath of office. So oath of office. Okay, if you have, and I hope that the lady who was just on is still on listening, because I think that this is going to better answer her concern. If you have sworn your oath, For example, you swear your oath to support and defend the Constitution, never having read it, that is called fraud, and that is a crime. Okay, if you have sworn your oath and you've read it, and you are like, you know, one of the many people who have told me, oh, Catherine, it's so cute that you think that we just get into office and then everything is all constitutional and everything, but that's just not the way it works in real life. Okay, that's called treason. When you get into office and you have the intent of ignoring the Constitution because you know what it's about and your intent is to undo it, that is called subversion of U.S. government. The treason and subversion of U.S. government, as John was trying to say, is a crime punishable by death. Thank you. It's that serious, and there are many other things that are you know, quite that serious, that it's not anything, you know, it's not a threat. It isn't a threat to the thing we call government because nobody knows how to execute that or to enforce it. And so that is why the necessity for a county committee, because when you have your county constitutionally literate and you're partnered, it's not you're getting your sheriff on board. There is no option. Your sheriff will be partnered with people or they won't be sheriff. When your sheriff, highest authority, highest law enforcer in the county, is partnered with people, then, you know, I mean, that is the only way that you're going to be able to actually lawful. There are other ways, but there's only one lawful and peaceful way to not only get justice, but to restore the republic, which is, you know, obviously absolutely necessary. If we don't do that, if we're not actually in the actions that we take, in our, it's not where, and we're beyond even a redress. You can't get a redress of grievance, by the way. You can't go down and exercise the fifth provision of the First Amendment, which is a redress of grievance. You can't get that because there isn't anybody in government, in the thing we call government, who knows what that means, first of all.
Well, we have to force them.
And
that's the only way to do it. And as you said, you know,
compliance.
You get your county groups get together, you get the Committee of Safety, you get the relationship with the sheriff. If you have at least maybe 100 people or so, roughly speaking, you've got a lot of power and clout. You've got the ability to walk papers. You've got the ability to recall people. And you get the sheriff on your side because he's looking towards the people. He's got to represent
your sheriff is partnered with you.
The
sheriff isn't on your side.
Right, but if you educate him, okay, and he understands what it is that is his purpose, okay, then he's going to be with you, and you're going to get a lot more done. So
yeah, right.
But yeah, most sheriffs don't know the Constitution, so they have no clue.
John, people need to understand that it's not if you get your sheriff. There is no option. We are at the point in our declaration that declares that when government becomes tyrannical, it is the right and the duty of the people to throw it off. There is no option here. We're at that point. This is what it looks like. And the only lawful and peaceful way to do that is with the sheriff. And if you don't have your sheriff partnered with the people, not on your side, it's partnered with the people. They will do the people with the people under the law, by law. It's not just the good ideas and best intentions of the people. It's by law. The sheriff will do what is required by law, or they're not going to be sheriff.
As long as they know the law, and unfortunately many don't. But again, we can recapture every. And we gotta cut this short. And listen, hold on a second.
I'm talking. Hang on.
But you've been talking for a while, and we're 16 minutes past the hour, and I got to end this program, but I just wanted to get a point in, and I'm in agreement with you.
I don't know why you would be arguing with me.
I'm not arguing with you. I don't know why you think I would be arguing with you.
I'm agreeing with what,
I'm going to have to mute you in order to make my point.
We don't need to make excuses for the sheriff to not be partnered with the people. Okay. So
I am not arguing that. I'm not arguing with anything. I'm agreeing with almost everything you're saying. I don't know if there was anything that I didn't agree with. And I was just really amplifying the fact that if you have a sheriff and you get a committee of safety going, and if that sheriff is not constitutional because he doesn't know to be constitutional, then he's political. Okay? And if he's political, hold it. Will you please wait a minute, please? Okay, you spoke for 15 minutes here. Hold on a minute. And so,
I don't think so.
Oh, I do think so. It's 17 minutes after, and you came on at 2 or 3 minutes after. So, yeah, it's 15 minutes. But listen, you know, all I'm trying to say is if he's political because he's a hack or whatever the case may be, it doesn't matter what he is. He's either lawful or political, okay? And if he's not constitutional and he's code appliance, then he's political. So, but the point is this. If you have a committee of safety that has enough of in the numbers and active in the community, and you make that relationship with the sheriff and you start off in the process the way we suggest you do, and I'm sure there are other ways, but it starts off with an education and preparing, and bringing your group together in a proper way with resolutions and purpose. And so once you do that and then you approach your sheriff, whatever it is, he's going to see that this is an active group of people. I better go talk to these people, see what's going on. Now you have the opportunity of educating that sheriff if they're political, and reeling that sheriff in, and hopefully giving him some realizations to come to his moment of realization, his Helen Keller moment, so to speak. Okay? And that possibility exists. But if he resists that group, he also has to realize that now here's a group of people that can hurt him politically because there are a lot of people involved. So then it goes from there. The other side of the coin is that they want to be lawful, and they're seeing when you approach them.
Some of them are.
I'm just saying.
Others are.
I'm trying to bring the program to an end, and I have been agreeing with you. But the only argument is
I've got another point to make.
Look, I took you on at a courtesy after the hour. I need to go to sleep. I got to get up in the morning. But I took you on as a courtesy because you were in the queue so long, and you spoke for quite some time. And I'm trying to end the program, so I'm going to end the program with that. I'm not in disagreement with you. But, either the person is political, and you may have...
I'm not done. Can you continue to talk?
But no, you're going to have to talk next week. Okay, next week you come back on.
People hear you, but they're not hearing the other... They're not hearing...
I give everything...
You're not hearing somebody who's actually running...
Okay, I'm sorry. I had to mute you. I really have got to close the program. If you want to talk, get into the queue next Monday, and we can pick this back up. But I've given you a lot of opportunity. I give everybody opportunity to talk. I never, ever, ever... shut anyone down. But, at this point, we got to close the program. We're 20 minutes over, and I need to go to sleep, so I apologize for that. But I did give you the opportunity to talk. And again, I'm not in disagreement with you. Okay, with that, we're going to close down for the evening. We'll be back next Monday, Lord willing. And so, Godspeed, everyone. Thanks for coming. Good night.